Good morning. The tax committee will come to order. Good morning, members. Representative Knuth. Welcome. Let's see. Representative Hillstrom moves House File 2321 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Good morning, Representative Knuth. Do you want to tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2321 is a property tax exemption about a unique situation relating to a railroad Y in New Brighton, which has had some it has significant impacts in the city with traffic and safety concerns, and has kind of developed into a unique situation. And so I'm going to let the mayor and community development director explain it briefly and answer any questions.
Welcome. Nice to see you, Mayor.
Committee member, it's a pleasure to be before you. First time testifying this year, which is amazing. It's always a pleasure. This is a project that...
Can we ask you to put your name into the tape? We know you. Okay, thank you.
This is a project that started in the 90s, but we couldn't afford to go ahead with the development of it. And we finally got around to it, and with the help of this body, and especially former Representative Char Samuelson and Representative Holbert, we were able to get $1 million towards a grant to try to replace the existing Butcher Spur with this Y that allows the coal trains to go directly into Wisconsin. And before, they were blocking three major intersections in our city for up to 20 minutes at a time. So it was blocking the western portion of our city from our public safety building and all the fire equipment. So this, the policy was put in place back in 2005 to allow us to go with $1 million, which we now have spent $2 million of the city's money trying to get this project done. And we ran into some issues with the that piece of track. I think everybody has a copy of the green. If not, did you get it distributed? Yeah. Okay, we have where the Y goes from the northbound track.
Mr. Mayor, if you can just give that to the pages, and they will distribute it for committee members. Yes, please.
What we're doing is we're trying to get the exemption of paying the taxes. Part of the grant said that we had to retain ownership. Give it to the railroads. We had to retain the ownership, so we've got a lease agreement with them, and we have to keep that property. So all we're doing is trying to get an exemption, so we don't have to pay the whatever $500 to $1,000 taxes a year on that portion of just the railroad Y. All this is track. So we're going to seek an exemption.
Okay, and we want to add, Representative Hillstrom is now going to move to get the bill in the form the author would like it. Representative Hillstrom will move the H2321A1 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. Representative Knuth, further?
I think the mayor explained it well. It's a project that has got unique circumstances, really important to the safety of our safety and traffic in our city, and because of the way it was funded and various other things, we need some help in the property tax area of it, and we'd hope the committee would be able to support that.
Okay. Discussion, members. Discussion on this new bill. Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against this bill? If not, Representative Knuth, we thank you for being here this morning, and we're going to lay your bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you for coming. Appreciate it. I'm not sure who to go to next. I'm going to ask Representative Less if he would like to do his bill. Representative Less has the bills, or would you like to wait? It's up to you. So you come back. Okay. We're going to do Representative Less. Representative Less has to go to his daughter's first communion rehearsal in a little while, and he'll be coming back. So, you know, we're trying to, you know, accommodate. We have people, you know, we're going to be doing a number of recesses today to get through things we need to get through today. But Representative West, which bill would you like to do first?
Thank you. Actually, Madam Chair, I'd like to do House File 2236.
Okay, so Representative West moves House 2336. Do you have an amendment, Representative West? No.
No.
Okay, great. To your bill.
Okay, members, House File 2236 tells the Department of Revenue they have to collect certain taxes on a portion of discounted hotel rooms. You may have read in the news, there are a couple of articles in recent months regarding Minneapolis and St. Paul's hotel motel tax. And in fact, as it stands now, when you book a hotel room from Orbitz or Travelocity or Hotels.com, they buy a block of rooms from, say, the St. Paul Hotel at a rate of, for example, $50 per room. And then they resell those rooms to you online at a rate of $100, $110, $120, whatever they can get. These companies then remit the portion of the hotel motel tax on the $50, but they do not pay the full increment then on the hotel motel tax or the sales tax, in fact, because you tax on both, for the $100, $110. So cities across the country have noted that this has been a strategy on the part of these online booking companies to avoid taxes, and several cities throughout the country have successfully won judgments in $21 million, $30 million, in order to make sure that these things are collected. I did check with Minneapolis-St. Paul. They both hired an attorney on a contingency basis to pursue the collection of these taxes from online hotel providers. And I'm just checking this out here one second. There's not a revenue estimate. However, I do have information initially from the Department of Revenue that it suggested that we stand to gain up to $32.9 million from ensuring that this collection occurs. It is in litigation, so up to this point, the Department of Revenue has taken a wait-and-see approach. Well, let's see what happens with the litigation that the cities are paying for on their own. But the $32 million is for the sales tax, of course, not hotel motel taxes, because those go to the cities. The sales taxes would be coming to the state, hence the $32.9 million estimate. After that, there was an additional email this morning that suggested that maybe that's wrong. I think word got back down to the people doing the estimate that, wait a second, revenue is taking a wait-and-see approach, and maybe it went back down to possibly zero. Nonetheless, based on experience of the cities throughout the country, as well as the confidence of Minneapolis and St. Paul that they will prevail, this money will come through, and I think it's important that we in the tax committee ensure that we're taking our bite at the apple as well to collect taxes, unpaid taxes that are due.
Okay. Questions? Yes, Representative Abney, please.
Madam Chair, Representative West, I'm not being an attorney. I'm always a couple of steps behind on understanding process, procedure, and then, of course, attorney's fees, as we like to talk about on the floor a lot. The scenario that I'm understanding you talk about is Minneapolis and St. Paul hire attorneys. The attorneys engage in litigation with the online firms who are participating in the process that you described. If, then, the two cities win these lawsuits, the attorneys, A, get paid out of the settlement, and B, the state then goes after these firms for the sales tax. Is there a provision then for the state that's benefiting from Minneapolis and St. Paul's legal work and fees to repay the cities for the costs? Because it seems like the Department of Revenue is a free rider on the work of Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Madam Chair, Representative Danny, I think you're right. They are provided. There is no provision that the state contribute to the attorney's fees. Hence, your description of free rider. The Department of Revenue is taking a wait-and-see approach, as has been stated. Part of the reasons, it's probably going to be that the way this was handled in other cities, for example, Anaheim, where they won $21 million, or Pitt County, North Carolina, they end up saying, well, we'll just wait for the local action to take place and then we'll be the free rider. So that may be why revenue is approaching this from that model as well. But there is no provision in here saying that the state has to pay if the cities win because they paid their own way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative
Lesch. Yes, Representative Anderson.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesch, why is it that the cities and not the State Department of Revenue go after the state because of the sales tax? I'm just curious.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, usually in most cases, the lost revenue to the cities represents a much larger portion of the jurisdiction's total lost revenue
than does, say, the sales tax portion of the lost revenue for the state. So it's sort of, I guess, potentially a drop in the bucket. $32 million is still a lot of money,
yeah.
But it just doesn't make it to the top of the totem pole. That's my best answer for you.
Representative Demmer, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, is it clear that these online companies are supposed to be paying the sales tax on their sales and they're just trying to avoid, or is there a question about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, if you ask, I think, objective people, they'll say yes, there's no question that these firms should be paying, but they're just engaging in successful business practices and you know, you hire lawyers and say, no, we shouldn't have to pay this. And, you know, it usually comes out in the wash beneficially to pay the lawyers for a long amount of time rather than pay the fees. So, yeah, I think there's no question that they're supposed to be paying this. But, can I just ask another thing?
Sure.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, the companies are saying that they're not reselling the rooms. They're attempting to make the argument that they're just a booking arrangement. That's their argument. And they think they can prevail that way.
Okay, so we have Representative Anderson and Cole. Oh, were you to that point, Representative Liebling?
No.
Okay, but we'll put Liebling. Representative,
Madam Chair?
You were to that point, Representative Lanning?
No, I think someone from Revenue wants to respond.
Yeah, we'll be, I'm to that particular question with, I figure the department's got a lot to say here. So, did you want an answer now, Representative Demmer?
No,
not
too much.
Okay, so, Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative West, this is just on what's not paid on top, so it's not going to be the consumer winds up paying twice the taxation because it's a pass-through anyway.
Right? Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, that's correct.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lasher, maybe it's a better question for Mr. Michael. I guess, you know, the statement of Representative Lesh that, you know, the companies are paying attorneys and they do the cost-benefit analysis, I assume that the attorneys are opining that they don't owe the tax, and so I'm curious as to what the legal basis is for that claim. Is it a nexus issue, or what is the basis for the claim that they don't owe the tax right now? I understand you have a different opinion. I may have a different opinion as well. I just don't know, but what is the legal basis that the online companies are using? Is it Nexus or is it something else?
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, the argument is that the online booking companies are saying that, as I understand it, they're not actually buying the rooms. They're just acting as a booking agent, and therefore they shouldn't owe the tax because it's more of a booking fee. That's their argument.
Madam Chair, I don't know if Mr. Michael has anything that he could add to provide any clarity on I mean, is that the extent of the argument? I don't know if you know Mr. Michael or if there's anything more than that.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, I'm really not fully up on this. I know, I think the argument could go two ways. One, the local hotel, which is located in Minnesota, is charging the online entity for purchasing these rooms, and the tax, and they're, as I understand it, I believe they're collecting the tax on that amount. So, I mean, just to take a simple example, if the online company is buying rooms in bulk for $100 and then they're reselling them at $150, I believe the tax is going to be collected by the hotel when it sells them to the online company at the $100 rate. But then when they resell it, they're arranging it at the higher rate. The tax is not being paid on the differential. I think Nexus would play into this because the argument would be under Quill, we're outside Minnesota. We don't have any physical presence in Minnesota, and therefore we're not really able to pay the tax. I think the flaw in that argument is that the state or the city in this case could argue not true because under agency principles, the hotel is your agent, and it sure is located in Minnesota, and therefore, you're probably better off having Greg Heck or somebody like that from the department, who I'm sure has looked at this issue, come up and talk about it. But there's some very interesting little nuances of how this would work out.
All right, Representative Coles. Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I'm not sure what I think about your bill, but I think, you know, there's a little bit more to it than we're just paying some attorneys to tell you not to pay the taxes. So I think that we should, you know, be careful about how we characterize what you know, what businesses are doing. I'm not saying they're doing the right thing. They very well may be doing the wrong thing, but it goes a little bit beyond that. They're just paying some lawyers to tell them not to pay the taxes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Coles. Yeah, I understand. I know the issue is complex, but in many other of these cities, the attorneys suggesting the tax needs to be paid have prevailed, and Minnesota's to a certain extent trying to get on board that gravy train. This is the Revenue Committee, and we're attempting to try to collect all the revenue that is due. So you're probably right, it is complex, but I think when it comes out in the wash, we have an obligation to go after this.
Thank you. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lesch. This is a really interesting bill, and thanks for pursuing this. I think you're really right. We need to turn over every possible stone here looking for money because, you know, if we don't get it here, we got to get it somewhere else. So when I'm looking at the bill, actually, I had just a little question when I first raised my hand, and that was just what do they tell the consumer when the consumer goes online and books? Do they you know, charge them tax, or they just not mention it at all? But what I... Before I answer that, what I just want to say is I'm looking at your bill, and the bill seems pretty innocuous. I mean, this bill doesn't say we must go after and sue these people, and we're going to take this argument. All it does is direct the Department of Revenue to do this by all available means authorized by law, and then it permissively says the Commissioner of Revenue may request the Attorney General to conduct legal proceedings if necessary. So I, you know, while I hear Representative Coles that, you know, there might be legal arguments that are valid, the contrary and stuff, I don't think this commits us to one argument. It just says, let's turn over a rock. If there's money there that should be coming to us, let's go after it. So there's my comment. Maybe you could just answer my little question about what they tell the consumer when you book. I guess I don't do that enough.
I have done that. I can't recall what they tell you. The fact is that the consumer pays the tax on that full amount when you book it. You pay the tax on the 150, not on the discounted rate. Hence the litigation about where's that other money going. I would also say this: the issue, the reason this bill is being brought forward is because the Department of Revenue has taken a wait-and-see approach, and we, those of us that believe the tax is due, are saying, no, hang on a second, no wait-and-see approach. Now, even if the Department of Revenue came in full force and said, we're going to do our best to collect this, because as it affects the sales tax portion, remember the hotel-motel tax, there's no motivation for the Department of Revenue to collect that because it doesn't go to the state. But the sales tax portion of it is, that being a relatively small portion, $32 million, if the department came in and litigated that or pushed it fully, these companies would still, you know, countersue or litigate it on their own to try to avoid paying it. The same thing would probably happen. That said, we would have the Department of Revenue as a full partner in this endeavor, and that's why I brought the bill.
Okay, thank you. I think we should follow up with what Representative Lanning was asking, ask the department to come up. Could we do that and have the department tell us whatever they want? And members can ask them questions for a little bit, because I think there's a number of people interested in something. Please, did you have a question immediately, Representative Demmer? No? Representative Demmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesch, it's your intention quite clearly to have the state be the agent going after these taxes rather than the city. Is that correct? In other words, if I read this correctly, city of Timbuktu, St. Paul, wants to collect these taxes, they can call City of St. Paul, can call the state and say, we want these taxes collected by law now, you need to collect those instead of the city going after them. Is that correct?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, not really. Even if the Department of Revenue comes on board and is saying, we got to collect these, the cities are not going to stop their litigation. The cities will still fully litigate because they have a strong interest in making sure the hotel, motel portion of that tax is remitted properly. So I don't think it will change anything with respect to the city's efforts, besides their paying a lawyer on contingency anyway. Unfortunately, taxpayers will lose that portion. It will go to the lawyers, but nothing will change other than the state participating as well.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Heck, and I'm an attorney to the Department of Revenue. There have been about 40 lawsuits commenced around the country on this particular subject. I think there's about 10 or 12 that are actively engaged in litigation now. Initially, a lot of the suits were brought in federal court, but the government units weren't successful there. The federal courts didn't really want anything to do with the subject matter until it was actually been resolved in the state courts. One of the reasons was that they said all state remedies had to be exhausted first before the state courts wanted to take up this particular subject. There is clearly it's a very complicated subject, and there's certainly a question whether nexus would apply in these situations. They certainly do have a contractual relationship with these lodging establishments, and I would have to believe that they probably come into the states to negotiate those agreements. They probably come in to view the premises. Obviously, their reputation is at stake, so I'm certainly sure they want to see the premises that they're accepting reservations for. One item that would indicate that this is not a clear-cut item is that virtually every suit that's been brought around the country, it's been brought by a private law firm on a contingency fee agreement. If this was such a slam-dunk arrangement, I'm sure the states and the cities would be pursuing this themselves. They wouldn't be paying out a large contingency fee to have at least private law firms bring this suit. Also, MPC has been working on this issue for about the last 2 or 3 years, and with the online industry, and they haven't actually been able to work on any solution yet, which indicates to me that these online companies aren't sufficiently worried yet, so they're not really coming to the table. They have nothing to lose at this point in time. This could really be a life and death matter for these lifetime for these types of firms, because it's going to be like a set of dominoes. Once there's a firm case established that these firms owe this tax, virtually every state and every city that has a lodging tax is going to jump on board and go after these firms. That's going to be multi-million dollar liability, potential tax liability for these firms. As Representative Lesh has said, there has been some judgments, but to the best of my knowledge, no one's collected a penny off these suits yet. Well, virtually all the judgments that have come down against these online companies are in the lower state courts. They're working their way up through the appeals process. There's certainly no state Supreme Court has ruled on this particular issue. Until there's actually some strong precedent, I think there's considerable doubt what success the states will have in pursuing these things. And that's part of the reason that the Department of Revenue has taken a wait-and-see approach here, because we don't think it's a clear-cut issue. If, in fact, you want to really collect the tax, though, I would suggest you've actually changed the law. Right now, we tax lodging and related services. Why don't we specifically say that one of the related services we're taxing is this online reservation service? Put it right in the law. That's why the argument these firms are making is that the states haven't really come forward and told them what their position is. We haven't issued a revenue notice in Minnesota. We haven't actually instituted any particular audits yet. And part of the reason we haven't instituted any audits is we don't really know how these firms operate. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence out there how they operate, but we don't really know exactly how they collect and charge this tax, how they share the revenues. Representative West has said, well, they're collecting tax on the whole $150. We don't know that for a fact. When you get the bill from hotels.com or something like that, you're going to see a charge on it for fees and taxes combined. There's no breakdown between state tax, local tax, and what their fee is. You have no idea. It's going to say $25 taxes and fees. You don't have any idea what taxes they're collecting or what fees they're what fees they're actually taking off the top here. I can give you a little personal story that I have. Last year, I took a personal vacation out to Utah to see the National Public Parks. My wife arranged through hotels.com to get a hotel near outside one of the national parks. We paid $150 for hotels.com, and that includes all taxes, fees, and the room. There was a little small fee because a month later we got a bill from the hotel for $125 on that same room, so they didn't realize they had already been paid by hotels.com. So what happened was that hotels.com basically, they got $25 there. Our understanding was that there was going to be like a 10% markup, so we thought their fee was $15, so they actually, their profit went from $15 to $25. I have a strong belief that additional $10, a large part of that $10 was taxes that was due and owing to the state of Utah and political subdivision of Utah that hotels.com kept. But I can't say that with any certainty. All I know is that we paid $150 on it. The hotel probably collected $110, remitted tax of $15 to the state of Utah, and the other $25 was pocketed by Hotels.com, and I'm fairly confident nobody got any tax on that $25. I'd be glad to take any questions on this subject.
I'm sure there'll be some. Thank you. Appreciate you being here, Mr. Heck. Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Heck, three short questions to follow up with your testimony. I'm assuming, based on what you just said regarding the judgment, that none of the companies have then gone forward and said, okay, we're going to comply and fully pay those state and local lodging fees.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, that is correct. Not, to the best I know, none of them actually paid the tax, and to the extent that they lost a lower court, they are appealing it up to a higher level of court.
Okay, thank you. No, I'm sure. Mr. Heck, to your knowledge, is it just Minneapolis and St. Paul in Minnesota that are pursuing this? Are there any other communities that have large lodging interests that have gone down this road?
Madam Chair, to the best of my knowledge, it's only those two cities currently pursuing it. Although initially we were contacted by the city of Bloomington a couple of years ago on this particular issue, but I don't believe they're pursuing it currently.
Thank you, Mr. Heck.
Madam Chair, to that point,
yes,
Representative Reiner, the reason Bloomington is not pursuing it has to do with some procedural matter as it affects Bloomington. I don't quite understand, but I was just told they would not benefit from it in the same way due to how they collect their tax.
Thank you, Representative. Of course, my interest is virtually every lodging facility in Duluth is in my district. So, Madam Chair, just anecdotally, to follow up with what Mr. Heck was saying, just recently I booked a hotel room online and I paid, in my case it was $15 in taxes and fees, and you're right, there was no breakout, I had no idea where it was going, and then when I got to the hotel, they charged me additionally for local lodging taxes, and I was told that, that what I had paid online did not cover their local lodging taxes, so it was a little unexpected surprise. So.
Interesting. Further questions for Mr. Heck or Representative West? Representative Anderson.
To that point, Madam Speaker, I am just wondering, you know, what kind of safeguards do we have to make sure that the consumer doesn't wind up paying twice?
Mr. Heck or Representative West, safeguards? That's by the department would have the best. Do you have any safeguards? So,
Representative Anderson, I don't think there's any safeguards per se. In fact, the example just given was kind of surprising to me that they actually paid. The online company then will build again at the establishment. I've never heard of that particular situation, but as we go along, we keep hearing more and more evidence of how these things operate. We just don't really quite know exactly how they operate. But generally, when you basically pay the online company, they would like to collect all the taxes and fees at that particular point in time. They don't want, and they have no interest in knowing the lodging establishment, how much markup they have. And I think they would like to take care of all the taxes and fees and pay the lodging establishment the agreed upon rate and let it go at that. I think they would like to operate under this cover of darkness. But there is no, basically I would say if you have a receipt showing that you pay taxes, I would say you should be protected from further paying any further additional lodging taxes.
Representative Anderson, further? No, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rice, it just occurs to me that there are a lot of attorneys being hired to try to sort out how this is supposed to work in the law. Here we are. Did you look at just fixing the law and making it clear so that they don't have to do so much litigating to try to figure out what the law is supposed to say or what they're supposed to do? Maybe we need to be clear in terms of how these transactions should work and how, I'll go back to the testifier's comment that maybe the law needs to be fixed so it's clear and there doesn't have to be interpretation. And then, you know, rather than directing the department to do whatever they have to do to try to get them to comply with what we have, did you look at just changing things in the law to make it clear or something like that?
I absolutely would if I was sitting in Congress, which has the Commerce Authority or authority to regulate interstate commerce. These companies are suing on the theory that, as was stated, the nexus issue, and in state court they're going to suggest state doesn't have jurisdiction to do this. under certain theories up to including the Commerce Clause. So
further questions?
Further? Yes, Representative Gardner, and then we also want public testimony for or against this bill. No, please, Representative Gardner. I don't know that the industry is here. I'm hoping, but we'll find out.
I was just wondering, Representative Lesh, if William Shatner's weighed in on this issue.
He has contacted me personally, and I hung up on him.
Okay, is there any testimony for or against this bill? No one from the public who wants to testify on this bill. It's just your chance. Someone's giving me a look like they're trying to decide. Okay. We're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative West, we know you have to go, so we'll do your other one when you get back later today.
Thank you.
Okay, so thank you. Sorry we kept you past your 9:35 deadline. Thank you, Representative West. Representative Poppy. Let's see. This is the wind energy tax. Who would like to move House File 2335? Representative Hilster moves House File 2335 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Oh, and I guess Representative Brown is here as well. Yes, please. Welcome to the committee this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to present this bill. This bill deals with Statute 272.029, which is a wind energy production tax. I just want to give you a little bit of information about that tax. It's a tax that's imposed on the production of electricity from a wind energy conversion system installed after January 1, 1991 and used as an electric power source. There are a number of subdivisions in this bill, or in this statute, and I want to be able to refer to those before I get to the one that we're here to talk about. But that subdivision 1, there's a tax, it does exist. Subdivision 2 defines what size of a conversion system you're dealing with. Subdivision 3 determines the rate of tax based on the size of the conversion system. Subdivision 4 deals with the reporting. It details the obligations that the owner has regarding reporting the amount of electricity produced. And it also deals with the Commissioner of Revenue and how he would notify the owner of the tax and how much they are due to pay to the county. Subdivision 5 talks about the payments and the penalties, and then we get to Subdivision 6, which is what this bill refers to. And Subdivision 6 deals with the distribution of revenues. Currently in statute, the distribution is 80% to counties, 14% to cities and towns, and 6% to school districts. We've been having some issues regarding the 6%. That goes to schools. Neither Representative Brown and myself, and we're co-authors on this bill, neither one of us was here when this bill was brought forth originally, and so do not have the history of that maybe others would, even at this table, to talk about the 80-14-6 split. But we are here now. I'm here to present taking the 100% and distributing it differently and having it an 80-20 split and not having the 6%, which deals with the schools. And what the 80-20 would do is allow for this statute actually to go back to the original intent that 100% is collected and 100% stays within the region where the wind energy is coming from. And so that's what we're here to talk about with this bill, and we'd appreciate your consideration.
Thank you. Representative Brown?
I have nothing to add to that.
Okay, thank you. Public testimony for or against this bill? Okay, so committee discussion. Representative Demmer, I figured you'd have your hand up right away.
I noticed you watched me right away, Madam Chair.
Well, yes.
But I thought you do that all the time, so.
No, I mean, members, this one's a tough one, so everyone should think about this a little bit. There's a lot of issues going on in this little bill. Representative Demmer.
Yeah, there are a lot of issues, Madam Chair, and I appreciate Representative Poppy and Representative Brown's work on this. As you know, I've carried legislation in the past and tried to undo this for the last few years. And actually, in thinking through there, I became aware of the solution here a few days ago about this bill. And in thinking through, Madam Chair, you know, from a public policy standpoint, if you think about the effect of the wind energy farms and the turbines and stuff that are being built out there, the costs, the societal costs of those really are borne by counties and townships where the roads are being used to haul the stuff in. This is really, really, really big equipment that's being used for this stuff. And if you think about the cost and the burden on the local jurisdictions, the county and the townships probably should be getting the revenue, Madam Chair. I mean, it was nice for the schools to have that. But from a pure policy, I mean, I still have other thoughts personally regarding this, but I think this is a good short-term solution and makes all kinds of sense in terms of having any kind of tax. And the other, the arguments still hold, Madam Chair and members, that, you know, the tax derived from this wind energy project is really a result of local investment, local risk, and quite frankly, the societal cost of these, whether it's visual, whether it's, you know, the wear and tear on the roads and that sort of thing, really is local and where these dollars should be going if there's going to be tax revenue generated. So I do support strongly what they're trying to do here, Madam Chair and members. I think it's a good idea, and there's good policy in it, too.
And members, everyone really does need to think about this a little bit. This doesn't matter if you don't have any wind in your district. This is like the Coonan bill on utilities all over again. For folks who didn't think that people had Prairie Island in their district was a local cost, here's the wind, folks. And this helps members understand that if you've got the burdens of the Target or the Mall of America or the utilities or the wind or whatever, you come forward as legislators and you argue for some relief for that. So this is another one, and people need to think about this because it's all set state policy, and there's going to be more and more and more of these over time in Minnesota. Representative Demmer, further?
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, if I could, though, there's a difference between this and Representative Kuna, for sure. I mean, this is not adding any burden to statewide taxpayers. You know, this is a tax being paid, it's a production tax being paid by the entity that owns the wind farm, which is locally owned, primarily, you know, with local investment. Now, sometimes it's dollar investment, sometimes it's just investment of your property. But we're not talking about taking any more state dollars away. We're just rearranging the tax already being posed and which local entity is it going to.
And Representative Demmer, they're all different. I mean, that's not really what I meant. I should say, we need to think about these, and I'll just put this candidly out to the authors here. We all thought this bill wasn't going to cost anything, and I was asking Mr. Michael right now, and he did not know the revenue estimate was here till now. It's here now, and there is a cost. And you authors don't know it, but we're not scheduling any bills to cost anything in the tax committee this year. Now it turns out it's $310,000, and it's internal in the public school tax, the school finance issues. You know, I've been clear to the members who are here that I thought this should be in the K-12 bill. It's a school finance issue. They've creatively come up with a way to make it a tax bill, because now it really is a tax bill. And so these payments to counties and towns, you know, go to the property taxpayers. In the current law, this bill makes the school issue also become a property tax, a levy offset, so that the people who reside in these school districts are going to get a benefit. They're going to be getting reduced property taxes like counties and cities and towns now. So I hadn't thought through that there would be a small cost. So I think there's a lot of issues going on here. Members have to think about this. I mean, the K-12 bill, well, you know, it's going to be here later today. Maybe we could put this on that. No, I'm just teasing. but there's a lot of complicated issues here, and this wind energy is going to grow. I've driven through these areas lately when I drove to the hearings in both Albert Lee and Winona. And boy, the landscape has really changed.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a tax bill now, the way they've got it drafted. It's not a school finance issue, and it does give property tax relief to the host areas. I think the way that the department originally came up with the idea on what to do with this money was to do it as an aid offset, which probably isn't the right way to do it, because the schools, because we don't equalize, the schools didn't get the money either, and the property taxpayers didn't get the money. Who got the money, as Representative Demmer has stated, the state, and that's what makes this cost.
Mm-hmm.
So neither their property taxpayers or their school districts are getting the benefit of these facilities right now. So I think they've got some really good arguments. We just need to think through how we're going to do this. Representative Fulber.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't want to open up another can of worms and go back to the Corner Bill, but I want to read a little statement that on Thursday, April 16th, Minnesota Power, Boswell plant coal silos were on fire. Originally reported at 7 stories high, they were actually 11 stories high.
the Cohasset Fire Department and the Grand Rapids Fire Department spent 40 men fighting for fire for 13 hours in dangerous confined spaces. And as a compliment, that Cohasset says that they're very grateful for Minnesota Power and for donating $10,000 towards the foam unit which we needed to have to fight this fire, and the new $500,000 truck that they needed to have. In the city of Cohasset, taxpayers had a chance to buy the $500,000 check, and they appreciate the $10,000 from Minnesota Power to go towards that.
Thank you. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess when we think about the big picture of this issue, I think it is complex. And one thing that jumps to mind is that, you know, we're talking about mitigating the impact of these wind generation facilities or this wind power, yet in all the energy bills, we keep focusing our efforts on making sure that there's more of it. And so I think that those things aren't in their own little silos. We are, by our energy policy, essentially requiring this discussion to occur in the tax committee because of what we're doing and what we will be doing, focusing more and more and more toward the use of wind energy, which is less reliable than other types of energy. So I appreciate the discussion and think that there's a very, very complex thought, I'm sure, that you'll be putting to it before it goes into your omnibus bill or not. But one thing I was looking at when I was looking at this chart, specific to, I guess, more of a focused discussion on this specific bill versus the policy overall, I mean, it does seem a little strange that we would use taxpayer dollars to send $8 to Elk River. Or is it, this is in dollars?
This
it's $8,000 or what?
No,
you know,
those are dollars.
Those are dollars.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those are dollars, and that is the amount of the wind production tax. That's the amount that the owner of the electric conversion pays to, and that if it's 6%, the chart that was distributed was for another bill, but it highlights where the schools are that are currently receiving 6%. What would happen with that is it would go to the counties or townships, or cities or townships now, that 6% would be, but those are actual dollars.
And Madam Chair and Representative Poppe, I think that there's some argument to be made for not transferring that small amount, but I'm not sure that there's no impact on school districts. When we think about some of the other things we do in the tax committee that school districts don't get to participate in terms of their choice, but they get to participate in terms of their tax liabilities, and I'm thinking about TIF specifically. You know, the school districts don't get to choose whether the cities go and put a TIF district in place, yet they get to participate. And so when I think about, well, maybe on this one specifically, the schools don't have as great an impact as the counties and the cities. In other ways, they certainly don't get to make some choices on some other things, and so I just wanted to make it even more difficult.
Yeah. Well, and Representative Broad, I mean, I think these are really good points, and I think the authors realize that. I think one way to look at this chart that Representative Broad has just referenced is it's currently a really inexpensive item, the problem. The 6% problem, so you look at the total, the middle column has all the dollars now, but it's just 6% in school. That's going to grow and grow and grow and grow. And then a future tax committee is going to have to decide, if we do nothing, that we're going to buy a $20 million problem or a $40 million problem. Right now it's a $310,000 problem. So, I mean, you know, and I think Representative Broad's points are right on here, and we need to think about all this, because the way it is now, the 6% for the schools, they're not really getting it. I mean, they're not getting it in a check to the schools, and the effect to them is that they're not getting it. I think what this bill is doing is directing it in property tax relief. And one way to think about it is, let's say any one of us had a business in our district move in. You know, let's say a big new Best Buy moves into our district, or a Walmart, whatever. We don't, you know, write a check to the school district for that. That goes into the tax base and thereby lowers the tax, you know, burden for all property taxpayers within the district. And that's kind of how it's working in cities and counties right now. But it isn't in the school, because the state is coming in and grabbing the money as a aid offset, taking it for aid, not returning it to the local district in a levy offset. So they're not getting it either way. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff here, and it's little now, and it doesn't seem like it affects many members now, but that's really going to change. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment on, again, on the Tarleton, a little bit about that. We actually represent, I think, three schools on that list, and they aren't receiving a big chunk of those dollars, but they are very concerned because they would like to receive the dollars. The school would like to be able to know that they got actual revenue and they are able to use that. This does change that. This would mean that the schools would not be getting actual dollars that they are going to see and be able to spend. But this should be a benefit to the taxpayers and the property owners throughout the district, either to the city or township or the county. And the reason why some people, I think, who live there would appreciate this is because they may actually live on a farm, but not, they live in a farmhouse, but they actually don't own the farm property, and the person may be an absentee kind of owner who is reaping any other benefits from the windmill that's there. They would like to be able to just know that, okay, you know, maybe my personal, you know, property taxes that I'm paying is not going to be, I'll be able to see some benefit to that. So I just wanted to comment on that. We also will have transmission lines because, as you talked about, we have windmills that are throughout southern Minnesota. They're going to have to be transmitted that, we've got to get on the electric grid so that everybody can benefit from that. And that's going to be an additional thing that you're going to just see. It's not going to be something we can talk about as far as, we just know that there's going to be more that's attached to this. And that's going to be bothersome for the people that are there. And I would like to say that Madam Chair, I just want to talk about the whether or not it's expanding and how much it can expand. We're fortunate, I guess, in southern Minnesota we have wind. that is something that we have. Throughout the state of Minnesota, there isn't going to be windmills in every pocket of every part of the state because they just don't have the amount of wind. It wouldn't generate the amount of wind. So yes, it could be unlimited, but it is somewhat finite based on the location, the geography of the land, and where you'd have the wind.
Madam Chair. President Brown, please. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to add also, when we talk about that 6%, what we're asking you to do is put it in with the other township money, which is now 14%. So we're not asking for a check to be cut at this in this bill. But to talk about the impact to the districts, and we do talk about the school districts quite a bit because that it originally impacted them directly. But having this money stay in the area and then actually go to the townships would be beneficial in that, when the companies came in and put up these windmills, the township roads were left in pretty bad shape as well. And that's being able for them to use those dollars to maintain the roads that were left in disrepair because of the work that came in and was done would be beneficial both to the townships and the schools who are running buses on those roads right now and repairing front tires and realignments. And, it would be very helpful, and I think it would be a wise use of the dollars.
Thank you. Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For any of the options, Representative Demmer, when you have the massive wind energy turbines that you have in your area, what happens to your tax base?
Any of you or Mr. Michael might want to, or Ms. Baker might want to talk about, I'm sure they're all differently situated. Representative Demery, you have a...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dietrich, my understanding is it doesn't change the tax base at all. This is personal property that's put on the property, and my understanding, and I'm subject to correction on this, but the reason, actually I do have a question that does get to this probably, but the reason for the production tax to begin with is it's not supposed to be added to the value of your property, from my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Right. Representative Dietrich, is it okay if we ask Mr. Michael to kind of bring this up further to get at your question?
Sure, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Demmer explained it correctly. Basically, the only additional tax base would be real property, which would be the, the pad that the tower is on. And so this tax, generally the property tax does not apply to personal property except for utility personal property, and of course this is sort of a utility, but this tax is paid in lieu of property tax.
Representative Dietrich.
Yeah, just to follow up, just out of curiosity, and because I know nothing about this, But a lot of these pads and these turbines are put up on agricultural land, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So what happens to the value of that agricultural land? So, and what I'm trying to get at is, for example, if your school district is going to go out for a levy, and you're using your tax base to help determine what would that be per home, having these turbines up and the wind energy, does that decrease the amount of revenue that a $100,000 home needs to raise $100 per pupil type of thing?
Madam Chair, I can speak to that. The quick and short answer, Representative Diedrich, is that's yet to be determined. I'm involved in Dodge County. There's a tremendous amount of work being done. Our county, which is a relatively small county, is very rural, is looking at potentially 300 or 400 megawatts worth of wind that wants to be put up, because we're, after the Buffalo Ridge, the region I live in is considered about the second best wind in the state. And now with the new technology and the way things are, there's a tremendous amount of interest, and there are developers running all over trying to put these projects together. You just touched on probably what is the biggest issue, other than revenues and other than revenues and how this all works. The tax issue is important. People, believe it or not, are paying attention to where these taxes are going, because as farmers, and that's the point I was going to make, when you talk about a power plant, when you talk about that sort of thing, you put that up in a place and yes, you buy the land and you're all set to go. These are scattered throughout the area inside the property. And the big issue is it's on farmland. And not just the towers themselves and looking at them, but you're putting a huge amount of concrete in the ground to support these things. They're designed such that someday when they come out, and this is a big issue, what do you do when these things become rusting hulks and they're sitting out there, the big toothpicks, not doing anything anymore in 50 years? They're designed to be taken off, and then the concrete base can be taken out to a level of 4 feet deep, so you can put dirt back on. But the concrete goes way, way, way down. We don't know how that's going to end up. They think that if they take off this top 4 or 5 feet of concrete, put the dirt back, they're back to farming. We think that's okay. The second issue, so we don't know. The second issue is farming practice. When you put these up, you know, people have their farms set up to fit their machinery. And this is a big thing if you're a farmer. How does, you know, because you don't want to have, you got 16-row or 8-row or 24-row planter or your combine, you don't want these rows to have to intersect. So you set your field up so that they all fit in the rows. Well, when you put this on, it changes that. And it doesn't sound like a big deal, but it is when you're going around stuff. The other, and a third issue is, most of this property now has field tile in it, has drainage tile. You basically what that does is controls the water table and holds it to a different level. And when you put these in, every one of those towers is connected by a transmission line. They bury those transmission lines. And they bury those transmission lines below the level of the tile. That means when they put the transmission line, they're cutting tiles. And every time you cut a tile, and that's even being figured out which way to do it. They used to go in and plow in the transmission line, then they'd come back and dig up and put the tile back together. Well, then they found out that when they cut that tile, they were stretching it 50 feet either side and causing big problems. And that causes drainage problems, not just right there, in the entire field. So there are all kinds of issues being dealt with in the agricultural clean. And then, ultimately, what is, to your question, what's this doing to the value of my farm? What's this doing? What's this going to do? 15, 25, 30 years from now, the next generation, my kids, if I don't, they sell the farm. What is this going to mean? Am I at a lower value? Am I going to increase the value? We don't know. That's all yet to be determined. Right now, it's about the cultural practice. It's about, you know, what's the best way to do this? Where do we site these towers? Huge issue. The developers coming in just a year ago, you didn't have any say in siting because it's all about the engineering and where it would go and the thing. And farmers are just saying, I don't care about your engineering. You're not going to send these lines kitty corner back through my farm. And I want to have something to say about where those towers go. And if it's not the perfect spot, no towers. You're out of luck. Well, without land, there's no tower. So now that's changing. And they're saying, okay, we'll let you have some say in where they go to make sure, back to the idea about where they go. And so it's a huge issue. And ultimately, what's the value change to my property? We don't know. That's to be determined because it's also new.
Representative Diedrich. That's fine. Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I wanted to add one part to that as far as we don't know what's going to happen with this as well. Representative Denmer did mention, you know, that we may be dealing with this in 50 years. And my understanding is these contracts are running for about 20 years. And Yes. And so the issues of whether they're going to stay on the land or be removed and all the other issues that Representative Demmer mentioned could very well be need to be addressed much earlier than this is not, this may not be 50 years or 100 years into the future. This could be within less than a generation.
Thank you. Representative Wofford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On just the issue of the impact of constructing these, I'm not sure if using a wind production tax is the best way to recover those costs. I mean, I can see where you could go across a township that doesn't have a wind generator in it to get to the parcel property that's going to have it and the township that's going to benefit. And, you know, so, I mean, there's going to be unequal benefits and costs. And one thing I think that the local government should think about in that area is I think is used in larger governments or larger cities is that you charge the restoration costs right up with the permits to come across that road and do it. And I think that's not an unusual sort of way of dealing with things. And I think the townships ought to talk to the League of Minnesota Cities and talk about how to do that, because I just think this is a really inefficient way to recover road damage money. I do think the impacts on school aid long term, since this is going to be a growing area, we need to kind of wrestle with.
Hey, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
That truly isn't entirely what we're trying to do, is just recover road damage area recovery. What we'd like to do is take those in lieu of tax dollars that was originally intended to stay in the district to stay in the district.
Just to talk somewhere.
I understand that. I just thought there might be another way to deal with that, particularly if you might end up with a government that has an impact that doesn't get the revenue.
And Representative Poppy.
And thank you, Madam Chair. I do believe that the county is, you know, kind of the larger local government there is, you know, they're doing what they need to do, I think, with regards to that. But, you know, as Representative Brown said, again, it's, you know, it's the modification of the change of the distribution of the dollars. The tax is imposed for the wind energy conversion system. If it's imposed, it's 100%. We'd like to be able to keep the 100% and have the distribution be 80-20. That's what this bill is. So it's, we get kind of off on the, you know, the schools and the other parts, but, you know, really we're just saying that, you know, there is a tax that's imposed. Right now 6% of that's going back to the state. We'd like to be able to keep that 6% and have the distribution be 100%, but 80-20.
And Representative Demers, or Mr. Michael, maybe for context, the 6% now that Representative Poppy is talking about, turning it back to the city town, adding it to 14, making it 20. So the 80-20. Can you remind committee members the timing of when the current formula happened, and then when was the 6% taken away by the Department of Revenue? I think that was in 07. I mean, the issue is, if Mr. Michael can just walk us through the timing, the schools were planning on getting this money, then the rules changed, and these members, including Representative Demmer, are fighting to get it back, because the state, I think, would sort of argue that, well, but we're still getting it. We're getting it as a school aid offset, but these districts aren't getting the aid anyhow. So they're trying to return it not to the school district in a check, but to the property taxpayers, which in the net effect of that, of course, is it does benefit the school district because property taxes are lower. So, Mr. Michael, can you just talk about the timing of this? This really is out of our area, actually, in the tax committee, because it was a school thing. But, Mr. Michael?
I'm sure, I don't know whether Ms. Baker can answer this or not, but we, because this is the school finance treatment of this is a school finance issue, I really don't know when exactly the rules, but one of the reasons though why the school percentage is so low is that these things were set, you know, right after the 2002 school takeover, and so school tax rates were sort of unusually low at that time, and I think these rates were largely sort of set, or these percentages were set about on what the tax rates were at the time, and so that explains the low percentage for schools relative to what we think about their various shares of the local tax. But I don't know, and I'm not sure that Karen knows when exactly the school finance rules changed on the state aid offset of these monies, or if that's always been the case. So I'm sorry we can't really help
Ms.
you.
Ms. Baker,
that.
You want to add anything there?
Yeah, the only, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the only thing to kind of follow up on is in the early years, in the three, I think, and four and five, we did actually use based on tax rates. And there was a lot of non-uniformity because when you looked at what the county share, what the city or town share and school share was between all these various taxing jurisdictions, it was so different that the department had a lot of issues and worked with the counties and said, you know, it would be better to make something uniform. And that's where that 80-14-6 came was, like Mr. Michael said, that was at a time when the school levies were very low and most of the dollars they really did want to go to the county and the township or city because of the host community and the cost to roads and those. And so that was made uniform, and the school share was very, very low because at the time their tax rates were low, and it was done for uniformity.
Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I had two things. First, a comment on Representative Loeffler's about the roads and stuff. These contracts have built in, the companies putting these in, fix the roads, they put them back the way they were and that sort of thing, any damage, because again, it's very, very huge equipment that's being basically used on township roads, and the township roads weren't designed for these multi-megaton cranes and that sort of thing. That part's all built in, and that's built into the cost of the project to fix the roads and put it back into condition. The ongoing cost of the use of the roads, however, is no different than any business that gets built where you now have more traffic. And that's ongoing, and so that was the reference I made to that. And quite frankly, I should add, too, that I mentioned about the rusting toothpicks that are sitting up there down the road. Representative Brown is correct. The contracts now are down to 20, 25 years with maybe a couple of 5 or 10-year extensions that are optional. When they first came in, about a year ago, they were coming in with 30 or 40-year contracts with 2 10-year extensions at the option of the company or of the developer, and of course the landowner said, no way am I going to obligate things for 60, 70 years. But bottom line is, to clean those things up, they're also the local planning and zoning authorities are making sure that there is either an escrow account set up and or some sort of a bonding situation set up for the ultimate cleanup of these things, whenever it is that they have to be taken down. So there's money being set aside to make sure that there's something there to take them down with. But my question was going to be, and my comment my question was going to be, and you kind of touched on it, the idea of the 80-14-6 to begin with and when that happened. The offset started, I believe, Madam Chair, in the 05-06 year, and I believe it was in the education bill, is when the offset began. Prior to 05-06, up until this year payable, that 6% is going to the school. The offset, I think, begins this year, but it was put into place, I believe, in 05-06. Because we've been working on it since then, in anticipation that this is coming into play. Dabney's shaking his head. I think that's right. But anyway, my question is let's just back up a little bit more. The whole idea of the rate of the production tax and the percentage splits, you touched on that. And that's what I was going to ask about is, the whole concept of how these things, why they're taxed the way they are and why the percentage splits the way they are, I guess, was something I was going to go back to, because we're kind of working the assumption that this is what it should be. Well, it was designed this way for a reason, and maybe that would give us some insight into whether this kind of a change should be made or not. And we touched on that. I'm not sure if that answered my question, I'd be honest, because I was just curious if we could run back the tape when they had this discussion. I bet it was a pretty, and I don't know, maybe somebody, Representative Carlson, somebody else was here when that was discussed. It'd be nice to know what the issues were and why they decided the way they did.
This has been the education committee, and all of us are kind of clueless, so please.
Actually, I was around a lot during that time. I think it really comes down to the fact that a lot of this value is in attached machinery or in the towers. And it was pretty clear they are not a public utility. They are a commercial company. And nobody wanted to say, well, we better start taxing personal property, because that's what the vast, vast majority of all of their property is. And the more the county commissioners and the various members and others thought about it, they thought, you know, going to a production tax really makes a lot more sense, because the more wind generation, the more production, the more tax,
whereas on the property side, that really isn't true. And so it seemed like a very logical kind of way to go, that as all of these towers get put up, more and more wind will be generated and, you know, the tax would increase. That's really where the only thing that's subject to tax is this, or subject to property tax, is like Mr. Michael said, the site. And there's pretty specific language that site, that the county can decide whether or not they want to put a market value on at a commercial rate. And I think a lot of them do. However, it's statutorily mandated that it has to be classified as if it wasn't a wind tower, and it has to be classified as the most probable use next to it. And just about all of them are in cornfields or farm fields, so just about all of them are classified as ag. But the market value that's placed on them is generally a lot more than what that 1 acre of ag land would have generated. It's a commercial value. So it's kind of a combination, and that's actually in statute for kind of valuation.
Thank you. Public testimony for or against this bill? Anyone want to get in on the wind debate? Okay, if not, we really appreciate it. You've given us a lot to think about. You got a good ally here with Representative Demmer. And we thank you, and we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Members, the remaining bills, we don't have all the information we're going to need here today. We're going to get the omnibus bills all reduplicated later. We're going to hear those again today as a courtesy. And the rest of the bills on the calendar are committee member bills. So we're going to recess right now till about 11:30, and we'll be back around 11:30. Yes, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At least a couple of us don't have the material for Lush's other bill. I don't know if everybody lacks that information.
No, we don't either. So we'll be getting a lot of these, and members know a lot of these bills. People are still introducing tax bills, and so we're trying to quickly get them. We're hoping not to hear any more tax bills after today. We may other than the committee's public finance omnibus and the omnibus technical and the actual bills, the omnibus tax bill, there's a possibility we may hear a couple tax bills Monday yet, because, you know, like, for example, we've had, you know, basically it's like we had a, you know, TIF districts go in at the final moment, and so we're hoping this is it today for members' bills, but there still could be one or two on Monday. So we still don't have, you know, the Department of Revenue, and we appreciate that, by the way. They've been getting estimates through with very little notice, and so we're hoping this is going to be it by the time we get through tonight for bill hearing. So we'll get all that to you. And so with that, we're in recess till 11:30. Okay, if Representative Dabney is ready, and Representative Demmer. Members, I'm going to call the committee back to order, and we were just waiting while Representative Dabney and Demmer, I think we're working on something there. And I am going to now move a reconsideration of House File 2 to bring it before the committee. Discussion to the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. And now I'm going to move House File 2 to be back before the committee. Discussion of the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. So, great. So, members, we've got House File 2 back before us, the omnibus K-12 Education Finance Bill. And I know that Representative Demmer and Representative Dabney were working on something, and I think they've got that figured out. And we're having, Representative Dabney is doing the omnibus K-12 Finance Bill for us today. So, Representative Dabney and members, if you could just stick to the tax items, which is what we traditionally do on other people's omnibus bills, and just tell us what pieces we should be looking at. We got the bill again, and then we also had last night a one-page handout that showed us what the tax items were, and I don't know if we have that again.
No,
we can get a copy. Okay, so Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Frankly, there are not a lot of significant tax changes in this bill this year. There was a zero tax levy for the K-12 committee, so there are not significant changes in that area. So the tax levies are unchanged for fiscal year 2011, pay 2010, as opposed to the governor's proposal that would have indicated some increases. One of the more important areas in of change in this does deal with other post-employment benefits. Under current law, school districts are allowed to create trusts to fund their other post-employment benefits, health care benefits to their retirees. This bill removes that removes the trust funds and allows districts either to do a trust fund or to have a non-voter approved levy to deal with those responsibilities. This provides school districts with greater flexibility and frankly probably also is more transparent to the voters what their tax levies are going for. There's a few other technical changes, including an increase, this is a bill of Representative Bud Nornes's, an increase in the number of signatures needed in a community to revoke an operating referendum question or provoke a reverse referendum. That goes from 15% of the signatures to 30% needed. And then there's some technical changes in truth and taxation, posting things to the internet as opposed to passing them out at the committee hearings, some tighter timelines for districts reporting some information and that sort of thing.
Okay, so that's the tax plan. Representative Demmer, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just can't resist asking Representative Demmer any questions. I believe in the OPED area, didn't we also, you can still bond to create the trust, but I believe we changed that from non-voter to voter approved. Is that true also for levying the bond to cover the, to establish the trust?
Representative Danny and Mr. Strom is behind you, too.
Oh, that's great. my memory is different than Representative Demmer's, but Mr. Strom's is reliable.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, Tim Strom from Health Research. Yes, the school district may still sell bonds, but only after voter approval. The effective date that's currently in the bill is August 1st. So the bonds would need to be, that are sold after August 1st would need to be approved by the voters before they could be sold. And yes, that's the change. And then other districts that no longer sell bonds for the OPEB could do an annual levy for that purpose.
Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Strom. Kudos to Representative Demmer. But I believe the timeline that's in the bill was to allow those districts that were currently going forward with a bond sale to complete that. And for districts in the future, then, to do it differently.
Okay. Further questions? Is there any public testimony for this bill? Public testimony for or against? Further discussion? And if there are any amendments, we'd love them. Representative Brock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gavney, just curious how Article 9 is actually financed. You know, one of the things we did early in session on a bipartisan basis, and I believe that you were one of smart guys who supported this work, is to require that we balance our budget for 4 years. And what this article will do is essentially bind us into future spending in a way that's not accountable on the spreadsheets. And so I'm just trying to find out what taxes are going to be raised to account for the $2.5 billion, I think, which is what I'm hearing. And maybe you can help me understand if that's the liability that our state will face in the out years.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, my appreciation of the numbers are similar to yours, but this does not begin until the 2013-2014, and therefore is outside the brackets that we work in. So that will be an ongoing issue, an ongoing question and challenge for us.
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, I appreciate how you call it outside the brackets. I think that is an accurate assessment of it. But my biggest concern, Madam Chair, is that this sets a pretty significant precedent. And on the House floor, you know, as we deliver within the bracket of 4 years, and this sets the precedent from the majority that if we want to do something, we're just, rather than pushing it out 4 years, we're going to push it out to the 6th year. So we're going to have tax cut opportunities in 6 years from now, which I don't know, you know, how you can put this policy in place and bind ourselves and other legislatures. Madam Chair, I don't even know if you're allowed to be tax chair at that point. So this is a very significant policy discussion and a very significant fiscal impact to the state, whether it's outside the brackets or inside the brackets.
Thank you, Representative Broad. And you know, Representative Broad's raising a good issue. And I'll recall for committee members, and that's, you know, that's the K-12 folks for setting that policy, but
And the governor is cutting the corporate tax rate in half, and that has definitely outside the four-year bracket. It keeps growing for about 8 years. So those are the issues that in the tax there we really do have to wrestle with. So, but people get creative. So Representative Rogers.
Madam Chair, just to that end, you know, the corporate tax cut is also expected to provide gains to the state by greater economic opportunity down the road. And on the Republican side and the Democratic side, in fact, Dane Smith himself agrees that that's the case in terms of cutting the corporate tax rate and what it could do for our economy. But, you know, this is a huge precedent, and this is something the K-12 committee has decided to do, and I think that's fair. But if this tax committee passes this bill out with this provision, this tax committee has essentially rubber-stamped or agreed with that approach. And so if the tax committee is going to agree with the approach that we shouldn't fund our bills for the long term, then I guess that's a precedent that this committee would be willing to set. I, however, am not willing to set that. I think that if we want to have a discussion over education finance, we should do it in a way that actually solves the problems and doesn't just push them off down the road.
Okay, so we'll have Representative Downey, Carlson, Loon, and Coles, and then we're going to go to the Demmer Amendment. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is I think just a technical question, but those out years then where we've made this commitment, even if those beyond the four-year current budget window that we have to balance, do those commitments then show up in the base? One of my observations is that we always view our deficit or budget cuts relative to the base, and so what is technically maybe a reduction in an increase always sounds like a draconian budget cut. And so I'm thinking here ahead 4 years, when all of a sudden these numbers are going to wind into our base, and then public perception and even much of our internal perception will be that we'll be cutting our budget, when in fact we simply overcommitted ourselves this year to an increase 4 years from now that we can't predict the circumstances on. So I guess the short question is this in the base then 4 years from now?
Yeah, I think we'll ask Mr. Strom how that would work, but I think one way for everyone to think about it, these comments are true across the budget. Health expenditures, you know, they get built in, you know, and then future legislatures can cut people off health care, so future legislatures can make changes. But interestingly for our committee, the tax expenditures, you just made an eloquent argument for repealing tax expenditures because they are built in and they just keep growing and they don't get examined and we don't raise taxes to cover them. So, I mean, yeah, this is right throughout all of the budget. And I believe it's in the forecast when you make any of these sort of changes, like keep a tax expenditure in the tax committee. But let's have Mr. Strom tell us how he thinks this provision will work going forward.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, yes, this would be a part of the base starting in 2014. And our current estimates are about $600 million higher in 2014 and about $1.2 billion higher in 2015.
Okay. Sir, from Downey.
So just to clarify, the sole funding of Article 9, my understanding was that it was $2.5 billion per year, but you're describing some kind of a phase-in, is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, yes, there's a four-year phase-in in Article 9 toward the end of that article. So the first year it would be 25% of that $2.4 billion, the second year $1.2 billion, and so forth.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Downey.
Just so that all members are able to appreciate, not trying to speak for Chair Greiling, but the way the phase-in is structured is so that all elements of the new Minnesota Miracle are phased in equally. She was very clear that she didn't want to take one aspect of it that might benefit some districts more than others and put that in first and follow with another segment. All the districts across the state will benefit equally from the phase-in as it goes forward.
Okay, and I didn't mean to touch that. Come down. Did you have more? I apologize. Were you? Please. There was something else.
No, thank you.
Okay, so Representative Carlson, Loon, Cole, Colbert, and the Demmer Amendment. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, with the numbers that were kicked around, I wanted to make sure people understood the real cost of the phase-in, and it was just responding to the
Okay, thank you. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and
I guess I just want to pick up a little bit on what Representative Broad raised, and I did speak to this on K-12 policy, because part of that K-12 policy bill that went on to finance and now has this provision also committed the school districts in the state to spending a specific portion, it was 5% as it came out of policy committee, of their general fund dollars on a specific new mandated purpose, assuming that this money would be there. And you know, Madam Chair, I guess you and I may have some disagreements on that, on tax policy and issues as it comes through, but one thing I would like to compliment you on, and I completely agree with, is sort of your pay-go policy, that we don't put things in tax bills unless we have a way to pay for them. And, you know, I've got another number of bills introduced during some things with regards to deductibility of health insurance and that, which I would love to see happen, but I don't have a way to pay for it, so I wouldn't expect you to be considering them today. But we're breaking that policy by putting this in this bill, and I know it's outside the scope of the two-year biennium or the tails, but it's still in there. And I think this is a significant departure from what has been discussed in this committee, and I just think it's a dangerous, dangerous precedent. It is not a good way to go. If this is important, then we ought to come up with a way to provide the financing and do it this year.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Rep. Cole. You know, I think there's a Saturday we are ignoring the laptop rolling committee. We'll just act like we don't see them, because it is a Saturday.
I'm also ignoring my own coat and tie rule, but
yes, it's Saturday. We have to be flexible. Rest in peace.
Madam Chair, I wish I wasn't going to sit and beat a dead horse because we've heard about this, but I'm going to beat the dead horse a couple more times. You know, this idea that we're going to, now that we have this four-year budget requirement that I think bipartisanly we agreed was a good idea when it was debated on the House floor, now we're going to push something out beyond 4 years, create policy but not fund it for 4 years. It's just plain silly. You know, people used to, the game used to get played around here, well, we'll push something off for 2 years and get it out of the biennium. And I'll be the first to admit that I did that once. And I did it because I wanted to get around a rule. And this is just plain silly. Earlier this week in the Legislative Commission on Fiscal Planning and Policy, the Speaker and the Majority Leader and the Senate Majority Leader talked about the need to be transparent with the public as we do our budget. This isn't transparent. We're creating a policy and we're not saying how we're going to pay for it. It's silly, it's wrong, it in and of itself is a reason to vote no on this bill. So I'm gonna stop with that issue at this point, but I do want to ask a couple questions about a couple other of the tax provisions in the bill. The other post-employment benefits change, I guess I'm curious as to what the discussion in the committee was, and I know we had some discussion here as well. I think we had some discussion here as well.
We had a joint committee here.
Right. Can you tell me why we're getting rid of the bonding or the trust? Distill down for me. What's the policy reason for getting rid of the current system and replacing it with this one?
And if I may just jump in, just, you know, we heard Representative Diskin's bill in the tax committee, which is kind of the same thing.
I was here for that, Madam
This
Chair.
Is just for the school side, but I'm the one to blame for that, Representative Cole.
I'm the one who
started the policy.
I don't care who started it. I want to distill down to, why this policy change. Can you dumb it down for
Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, Representative Cole, let me try and summarize the arguments that Representative Marquardt put forth when the bill was heard in the K-12 committee. That bill was House File 2224. Essentially, Representative Marquardt's argument was the trust could still exist, but that school districts shouldn't be able to issue the bonds without voter approval, that school districts essentially shouldn't be bonding for this obligation unless the voters approved it, but because there was levy authority for some districts to do this, that other districts should be able to access that levy authority for their post-employment benefit costs on an annual basis. So the goal of Representative Marquardt's bill, and again, I'm summarizing what he said at committee, was to
to take those districts that haven't already sold bonds and instead say, if you've got some post-employment costs, that you can have an annual levy for those costs, but that you're not going to sell bonds for those unless your taxpayers approve the sale of those bonds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have concerns about these non-voter approved levies. I always have. I've raised those issues in the past. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it here. But I do think that, I mean, this is a significant concern for me. We have a lot of issues with our public employee retirement benefits, not just here in the K-12 area, but we have those issues in the pension area. We had some discussion in the Public Safety Committee about some of those issues as well. And here we are essentially authorizing a school district to go ahead and incur further liabilities or additional liabilities and not have any voter approval of that. And it kind of takes away some of the ability of the school board, I'm concerned, it takes away some of their leverage in terms of negotiating some of these things. I'm concerned about that, just generally.
Okay, we're going to go to that point, but I think, Mr. Strom, please correct me if I'm wrong. I think it's kind of the converse.
Yeah.
I think right now, because of my bill, didn't have voter approval. I'd like to eliminate them completely, voter approved or not. But in this bill, it's adding voter approval. Am I wrong on that, Mr. Strom?
No, Madam Chair, you're correct. Representative Coles, under the current law is that any school district right now can issue bonds without voter approval. The current law allows by board action the boards to issue the bonds and put those proceeds in a trust. The change that's in this bill would take that authority away for school districts, would only let them bond if their voters approved it, which in most estimations will probably mean most school districts won't be able to go the bonded route. And instead, they'll be able to do an annual levy for those. One of the criteria for the annual levy is that they have had to have sunset any provisions in their contracts that create those liabilities for future liabilities. So the levy authority, the annual pay-as-you-go levy authority, is only available for those school districts that have sunset the provisions that lead to the post-employment benefits.
That's cool.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Strom. I appreciate that. That does help clarify that piece. That takes care of many of my concerns. Thank you. Let me ask one more question about another piece of the bill, Madam Chair, if I could, and then I'll be done. The change in the requirement for a revocation of an operating referendum levy from 15% to 30%. Can you talk to me a little bit about the policy behind that and how often has that occurred?
Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair, Representative Winchesky, as far as we're aware, there's been one successful revocation election in the last 20 years. So we're aware of just one revocation of referendum authority by election. The situation that prompted Representative Nornes' bill involves I believe, the Frazee School District. And the issue that caught his attention is the district had tried for several years to pass a referendum. The referendum finally had passed after failing a number of times, and immediately after it passed, some voters in the district filed a petition to revoke that election. Representative Nornes had his school folks testify about that, and his position at the committee hearing was that the bar should be higher than the 15% limit for the revocation election. I think that's sort of a policy choice for people to consider. One other point I should raise about this: the Senate, in their omnibus bill that has passed, the Senate has repealed that authority for a revocation election entirely.
Representative Coles, I'll just tell members I want to thank Representative Greiling, who is not here because she's with her mom at a nursing home in Rochester today, and we heard from her last night. But I do want to tell you, I talked to Representative Greiling about 7 a.m. this morning, and she actually cited this provision to me and told me that Representative Nornes needs this provision, and it was a good provision, and the committee thought long and hard, and the superintendent, and so, we don't know a lot of detail about this, so I'm a little reluctant, but I do know that Mindy Greiling would, if she could be here, would be fighting for Representative Nornes, and I'm out of my league here, but she had the wherewithal to make sure to tell me that this morning.
Madam Chair, I guess that I was going to be done, but you just, is this retroactive?
Madam Chair, this essentially would apply prospectively so that if it passed from the effective date of this provision, a revocation election would need the full 30% of the registered voters not the 15% that's currently required to revoke an existing referendum.
So, Madam Chair, my question then for Mr. Strom, I think, is would this have implications for the actions taken in the Frazee School District?
Madam Chair, Representative Thorpe, I'm not sure where the Frazee revocation petition was found to be invalid last summer, and I don't know what was involved in that decision. I suspect that there are a number of people still very angry in the Frazee School District, so I would not be surprised if another revocation petition gets filed this year.
Okay.
Madam Chair, that solves my... I was concerned that we might be changing something retroactively and, you know, getting in the way of something that's already been started. But, if this is in fact what we do decide to do, at least people will know what the rules are when they start the petition process.
Thank you. Okay, so Representative Fulbert, or no. Representative Garofalo, were you to that point, or were you correcting on the voter approval part, too?
No, I'm just going to explain what's been said about the sunset. Sunset clause for the current benefits. In order to do that levy authority, you have to sunset the OPEB benefits right now. So,
thank you very much. Representative Holmberg.
OPEB.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since Representative Greiling is not here today, and Representative Dabney and I are on, and many of you here are on the K-12 committee and have watched this bill evolve and gone through a lot of ups and downs, and actually many more ups in the communities and downs, I feel like I need to address some of the statements that have been made today. And first of all is addressing the lack of transparency and putting the bill, the Minnesota Miracle out in 2014. Actually, I am a huge advocate for transparency, and I can't say that there has ever been a bill that is more transparent than this one. When you have a term like Minnesota Miracle being used all the way across the state, north, south, east, and west, it is on the lips, not of lobbyists, not of legislators, but actual people in the classrooms, in the schools, in the school districts. And I personally have been to many of those school districts with Representative Greiling presenting this bill because I wanted to know what the real public thought. And out of all the testimony that we have heard, and I wish I could cite for you how many different communities, how many different cities that she has been to, I bet I have heard maybe 4 mild concerns about the nature, about one piece possibly of this bill. And that is absolutely, I think, incredible. So if that addresses the transparency thing. The other thing that I want to speak to is that this is a funding reform bill. Many of us have been engaged in some sort of reform here at the state in various topics. I, for one, took a look at property tax reform this legislative session. Well, all you need to do is start trying to reform something, and you realize all the obstacles that you face. The troops surround you very quickly. All of a sudden, all you have is a work group. Well, this bill started as a work group, and actually it was the governor's work group. And when he decided not to pursue it, because for whatever reason, there were a group of stakeholders that continued looking at the funding formula in the state of Minnesota and how we should reform it to get fairness and adequacy in the state. And they took every aspect of the inadequacy of our formula and reformed it. They took the lack of inflation in our funding formula and addressed it. They took the dependence on property taxes and reversed it. They took into consideration terrible transportation policies in some of our local school districts. And reformed it. They addressed the difficult problem that all of us have been talking about, is declining enrollment in our school districts. And there are so many more pieces to this that even just mentioning those few is a huge inadequacy. But they took every single concern and put it in a funding formula, in a funding reform. So when people talk about the fact that this is, silly, I just have a very difficult time with that. It is actually anything but. What I call it is visionary. There is not one of us, I think, in this room that at one point during our campaigns or when we're talking about education funding that doesn't say, oh, the formula is so inadequate for my district. Or the formula is so inequitable, and we need to fix that. And that's what I'm going to do, is I'm going to go to the state and fix that. Well, as I mentioned before, it's a very difficult job to do, and this has had lots of transparency. It's been across the state. It has been talked about for so long, and so I just needed to make those comments about this bill, because no matter how I feel about the bill, those are the facts, and that is the actions that have surrounded this bill. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Dietrich. Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, to that point?
To that point.
In reference to my comments about transparency and silliness. And
Madam
Chair, Representative Dietrich, undoubtedly, Chair Greiling and others have been across the state talking about this proposal. But, I was wrong in my understanding of the other post-employment retirement benefit provision here. So if I'm wrong, please tell me, and I'll be happy to acknowledge I'm wrong. Be transparent about how you're going to pay for the $2.5 billion of new spending. That hasn't been transparent, Representative Dietrich, and we're pushing it off 4 years so we don't have to answer that question today. That's not transparent. That is silly. I'm not saying that people haven't been transparent about their desire to change the formula or to spend a whole bunch of additional money, but we're not being transparent about how we're going to pay for it, who's going to pay for it. That's a discussion that we should be having as well, and by pushing this off for 4 years, we're not answering those questions.
Representative, please.
I think by having it in the bill, it will become very transparent as to how we will have to pay for it. Otherwise, it won't be implemented. Somebody will have to change it.
Then
we get back into the position that we always are in, where you use the language of the word cut. And any time you try to reform or any time you try to change what is now in law but not funded, it's a shell game. So while we all might like to move in the direction we're going, I think it's incumbent upon this legislature, if you're going to put the policy in place, you got to fund it. Because if not, then it's not transparent, it's not open, and the policy then will be essentially ground in stone, and any attempt to change it will be seen as a cut or a removal, and the interest groups surrounding it will try to fence any movement, any change out. And so what this legislature is doing is punting. We're saying we like the idea, but we're going to have somebody else figure out how to pay for it, because we can't make that tough decision now. We can't make that decision on how to pay for something that we're putting into law, and that's the concern. Thank you.
No, I don't. I just so fundamentally disagree with that. I think that this is extremely transparent, and I think that now the job is before us if we truly want to implement it, which I have already mentioned what widespread support there is for the bill. Then it will be incumbent on us to find the funding sources to fund it. Thank you.
Okay, so we've got Downey's next on the list, but Liebling to that point.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, first of all, I mean, we're in the Tax Committee, not the Education Committee, so, you know, I don't know how much we need to really open this can here, but, you know, it's so unfair, I think, to frame it that way, and if we want to get down that road, we really can, because, I mean, we've got a governor who wants to borrow money, $1 billion, to float this year's big shortfall, to not have to make the decision now that needs to be made, to raise the taxes now to pay for what we need to do now. So, I mean, we could frame an awful lot of what goes on around here that way, and, you know, we can talk about things one way or another way, and, you know, I don't know if we want to spend our time on this beautiful Saturday morning doing that, Representative Broad, Representative Colts, but, you know, I really wish you wouldn't, you know, try to, you know, we're doing these political speeches, and, you know, we can do the same thing back, because there is $1 billion in not pay-as-you-go that the governor wants to do that somebody's going to have to pay for later, and he's not telling us how that borrowing is going to be paid for later. You know, there are tax cuts he wants to make, at the same time giving big tax cuts to corporations that he's not really paying for. He wants to basically borrow to pay for them. That's what his budget does. So, you know, let's not go there. Let's get on with the tax stuff in this bill so that we can go out and visit with our families on this beautiful Saturday.
Thank you. Representative Downing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comments actually are to this point as well, but I do have some questions from within the spreadsheet too. But I just sent out my voter survey, and I did not limit it to Republicans in my district. I actually distributed it broadly, and I included the very question about whether voters in my district who have a very high propensity to approve school levies and bonding and never shy about spending good money for education in my community. And when I use the words Minnesota Miracle 2, which would generate a $2.5 billion annual funding increase, i.e. a 35% funding increase to education on an annual basis, my voter surveys came back with an unbelievable percentage not in favor of this proposal. So I think if we go out and use the word miracle, who in Minnesota doesn't like the miracle, right? The miracle on ice, the Minnesota miracle. But when you attach $2.5 billion of new funding into education along with the Minnesota miracle, and I heard the Minnesota miracle hundreds of times in my committees this year, never once was the $2.5 billion per year Minnesota miracle part of that. So if we went around the state and talked about the new Minnesota miracle and listened to everybody's concerns about the funding formula and said, sure, we'll fund those concerns, of course they're going to be in favor of it. So I really think the lack of transparency that Representative Coles has referred to is absolutely right on, and I don't think it's just about how we're going to pay for this in the out years. I think fundamentally the proposal never was presented with the total funding implications for the state of Minnesota. And to the questions or the points made about borrowing $1 billion or bonding $1 billion, actually I think that's a pretty concrete repayment commitment. When we bond against those future revenues, we know exactly what we're doing. What this proposal does here, walk this thing out 25 years, this is $50 billion. $50 billion. Compare that to paying back the bond on a $1 billion bond. I mean, there's no comparison here. And so I think the lack of transparency is there. And if you ever explain it in the true context of what the miracle will cost, I think people will understand, and you'll see what I saw in my own district. With that, I do have a couple questions on the spreadsheet. And not having been in K-12 finance, some of these things I'm sure were covered in great detail there. But when we look at the aid payment shift line on the spreadsheet, line 14, the governor's budget had an 80-20 shift, and the Democrat, this budget here, shows a 73-27 split. And yet the difference, the FY 10-11 total difference, is almost double in terms of what that kind of holds back from school districts and gives us to spend. If somebody could explain how just a 7% shift translates to such a big dollar shift.
Mr. Strom, is Mr. Crow here?
Madam Chair, no.
Do you know?
Yes.
Sure. And just for members, Mr. Crow is the fiscal analyst similar to Ms. Templin and Ms. Phil, who could actually do the spreadsheet work normally, but Mr. Strom can take a shot at it.
Thank you, please. Madam Chair, Representative Downey. On the shift percentage points, the columns that are being compared here show the difference between governor and base, as well as the difference between house and base. And so it's the difference between those two numbers. One of our rules of thumb for the aid payment shift, about $65 million per percentage point. So the difference between 80 and 73%, those 7 percentage points, each one of those costs or saves, depending on the way of looking at it, at about $65 million.
And just
quick thoughts. Okay, Representative Downey, please.
So it's because we started at a 90-10 split base, that's why there's... Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then maybe for Representative Dabney, if I could.
Yes.
As I drop down the spreadsheet and look at some of the subtotal columns, subtotal lines, it appears that the governor's budget ends up somewhere in the neighborhood, if you include the shift, somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion more to K-12 education funding in this biennium than this bill. Can you just give me a quick broad brush of where those differences are, where the governor was funding more as compared to this particular
Representative
Downey,
who is now waiting to Mr.
Tom. Madam Chair, Representative Downey, the big difference, obviously, is the shift. There's a couple of subtotals here for you. If you go to the back page in line 256, that's the general fund expenditures, not including the shift, and that's probably the most helpful line for you to look at. Essentially, the governor's got some new spending in his K-12 proposal, and the biggest chunks of that, so outside of the shift, which is, as I said, about $65 million for each percentage point, the governor had new spending in his bill, and that spending, there's a couple of major categories of that that are listed on the front page. The first of those was the expansion of the QComp program, which is line 21. And the second one was line 20, the pay for performance programs, and those two lines were a large part of the largest part of the governor's recommended new spending. So that captured more than 80% of his new spending. Those two lines 20 and 21.
Okay, so thank you. And to that point is Representative Carlson. We have Zellers and Broad. Is someone else at that point there?
Yeah.
Representative Garofalo's going after Representative Carlson. Please, Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I wanted to go back to the Minnesota Miracle and some of the comments about cost. Earlier when we were talking about the cost, keep in mind it's $600 million in the first year and $1.2 billion the second year. But while we were talking, I asked Mr. Trump, because when the bill was before the Finance Committee, Representative Ryland said that a lot of the Minnesota Miracle cost are property tax related. And Mr. Trump just confirmed for me that there's $600 million per year in property tax related. Mr. Downey, I'm just right up Highway 100 from you, and my folks like property tax relief and Robbinsdale and Crystal, and I'm sure when you drop a little bit south into Regina, they like property tax relief as well. So I think that has to be understood when we're talking about the cost factors here. A big part of that is cost shifting away from the property tax.
Okay, and Representative Garofalo to that point, and then Representative Zellers.
Well, just 2 points. The one thing is, as big as these numbers are, and Mr. Strom, correct me if I'm wrong, the $1.8 billion figure is actually assuming that there's no inflation between now and 2000, and particularly your 2014, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, the way that it's drafted and the costs are calculated between current law, so if there were a formula increase in a subsequent year, there'd actually be a smaller increase to fund it because the formula allowance is fixed at $7,500. So if there were any legislative actions in the next 4 years, the cost would go down. But then the formula allowance for fiscal years 2014 and thereafter is increased by the rate of inflation. So for years after 2014, any inflationary increases would be built in that formula allowance.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Strom, but the baseline of, for example, the compensatory funding formula allotment, the per pupil allotment, those are all based off what current needs are today. And so when we're talking about needs and what we need to fully fund our school system, the inflationary environment we're existing and we're going to see costs rise. If one assumes that a dollar today is the exact same thing as July 1st in 2013, then that's what the cost is. But costs are going to rise. We've seen that. So if we're assuming inflation, the cost, the actual increase, goes up. Am I stating that correctly or in a different fashion?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I think you're stating the concept exactly right, but the bill has a fixed funding formula in it of $7,500 is that formula allowance. So if the cost went up, I think the way I would interpret that is that the bill does a less good job of funding the cost if that was the goal of it, because costs have gone up in the meantime.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Strom, but in the bill, that $7,500 is going to be increasing for inflation automatically going beyond 2014. So one would assume that they would want that exact same of concept going between now and 2014.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I think that's a fair assumption, but the bill itself, the way it's written, starts at $7,500 regardless of what happens either with inflation or with the formula allowance between now and 2014.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Strom, the original point I was actually going to make was you referenced line 256 on our division spreadsheet and the governor's pay for progress proposal. the expansion of QCOM statewide. Could you elaborate, if we go down further to line 271, we're seeing the effects of the stimulus package, and the governor has dedicated more of the stimulus package to K-12. By my count, about $185 million more than the House proposal. Could you just elaborate on that part of the, when we look at all funds, again, we want to look at all sources of funding, Madam Chair, not just the state side of things, but we include federal funds. Can you explain that to them?
Okay, and just a second here, Mrs. Trump. Okay, so we're on to that point. So now we're kind of jumping ahead of people on the list, but we're going to have you answer that. But members, we're trying to focus on the tax issues in this bill. Mr. Trump, to Representative Garofalo's questions.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, the federal funds for school districts that were part of the stimulus money show up in the back page of that spreadsheet on the last step of line from 264 forward there. The federal funds came in a couple of major categories, and the largest of that was about $600+ million in a category called the Federal Stabilization Fund. And those funds could be used for any purpose, and both the governor and the House used those funds to offset cuts elsewhere in the budget, essentially to backfill those cuts. And the difference is the amount that's gone into K-12 to fill the cuts versus other areas. So there are different approaches to how that how those cuts are filled. In the House, I believe a larger share of those federal funds was devoted to the higher education cuts. But essentially, the way that those federal stimulization dollars are being used under both the governor and the House's recommendation is they're all offsetting the otherwise state aid that would be paid. So it's a question of which category is being offset.
Okay. Representative Ballard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. I'm sitting in a different spot, so I was waving to be in on the other food fight.
Oh, sir, come on.
No, that's all right. Now I learned that we've supercharged our non-transparency, but you know, we sit on the table and wag fingers at each other about who said what and where, but some of us actually do take serious what the Chair has said. We introduced a number of tax credit bills, other business incentive bills in the last couple of years that I didn't introduce this year because the tax chair, Chairman Chesky, made it quite clear we're not going to hear bills that cost something. We need to be transparent. You have an idea, you have to pay for it. Those were her words, not only to us, and maybe that's why the outrage is coming so inflamed from the other side, but this is what she told us. We listened. Some of us didn't maybe want to on some of the bills because not just there are ideas, they're good ideas that we bipartisanly share when it comes to research and development credits, when it comes to small business, governor's idea for jobs may or may not be a good idea, but some of these things are important to us. But we didn't introduce them, or didn't even submit a hearing request for some would say political purposes. Oh, I put in a bill, but the chair, the mean chair of the tax committee didn't give me a hearing. Some of us didn't even do that. So wag your finger at us and say, oh, this is just a political speech. There's nobody out on the lawn today, so don't worry. They're not down here listening to us. It's just lobbyists and staff. But to say to us that you can't do that, you have just because we say what the chair said back to you, if it's somehow political speech, that's not fair. If you're going to pay for it, if you're going to offer something and now supercharge it after Representative Garofalo's question, supercharge it with inflation in the out years, you better be honest about how you're paying for it. That's what the chair asked us to do. That's what everybody in here should be doing. But, Madam Chair, I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Really appreciate it. Representative Brock?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your kind of pause to remind us that we're trying to talk to the tax issues in the bill. But I think we're also focused on the tax impacts of the bill, and I think both are fair game for the discussion, so I appreciate that reminder. But the tax impacts of the bill are multifold, and Representative, you know, we disagree on a lot of stuff. But I'm okay if you want to call political speech my asking what things cost and how we're going to pay for them. I'm perfectly fine with that. But Madam Chair, specifically I have a question on a fiscal issue that I think could create an impact to this bill. And I'm wondering about the elimination of the special education service to non-public school children. And I understand that there was a fiscal note that's in process that maybe isn't done. Is that completed? I'm wondering if we've better defined the impact to the state general fund or to the educational budget related to that component, which has the potential, from what I understand, of shifting up to 2,500 special education students back into the public system that currently are served through private school mechanisms at their parents' choice.
Okay, so is there anyone from the department here who can answer on the fiscal note, or if not, Mr. Strom? Otherwise, if there is someone else, please come on down. Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, Representative Newton had discussions with the department yesterday afternoon about where they were in the process. They're working on that fiscal note, but as of the end of day yesterday, about 5:30, there still wasn't any information about whether there would be a fiscal effect or not. If it's helpful, I could give the committee a two-minute view of what the fiscal argument is about that, and Representative Dabney or Dietrich may want to speak about the policy behind that change. But essentially, under our current statutes, parents can unilaterally place children in special ed settings, and special education funding in those settings comes from the state for those placements. The student is generally in these circumstances attending a non-public school, and the parents are paying tuition to the non-public school. The argument that was made by the representatives of the non-public schools in the committee was that if the parents aren't allowed to make those placements and have the special ed dollars follow them, the parents aren't going to keep the kids in the non-public school, and instead those children will return to the public school setting. And because special education revenue is capped, it's really an allocation question. If the state's allocating more to the non-public students that are unilaterally placed, then there's less available for the school district. So there's no change in the, and vice versa, if those students receive different treatment that's provided by the school district instead of a unilateral placement, then there's no change to the state. There's no appropriations change to the state because the statewide amount of special education revenue is capped. So there's reallocations there. But the issue where there may be costs, and this is the issue the department is considering, is whether or not students will leave the non-public settings and come back into the public school so that we'll have more pupil units, more general education money that will need to be paid out. And as I said, as of the end of day yesterday, there still wasn't any indication from the department about the fiscal note or what side that might be.
Okay, so Representative Dabney or Dietrich, do you want to comment?
Madam Chair, Mr. Strom covered the finance dimensions well. Representative Newton has, in his previous service on the Anoka-Annapin School Board, was very involved in work around special education. He has continued that here. This was part of a conversation with stakeholders about what mandates can we relieve our system of. And under current law, a non-public school that accepts a special education student gets 100% of the costs covered by the state. A regular public school that has a special education student gets approximately 68% of those costs covered by the state. So there's an unequal playing field where we are subsidizing the non-public school expenses to a greater extent than we are the regular public schools. So the provisions in this bill simply set a level playing field between the non-public and the public schools with the same student. Some of the issues around the fiscal note will be what, if any, students will move from the non-public setting, who are already in the non-public setting, will move to the public setting. The assumption, one of the underlying discussion points is the non-public schools traditionally do not take on the really expensive special education situations. They of course, have the ability to discriminate against special education students. They do that. The expensive special education students who require a great deal of assistance, including medical assistance, are already in the public sphere. And so any special education students who are coming over, would come over to the public situation, are probably lower cost special education students with less debilitating disabilities.
Representative Dietrich, did you have anything to add on that?
No.
Okay. Representative Rodgers.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that description, Representative Dabney. I know you're involved in this in a way that I'm not. I guess I'm confused at the argument, though. If the argument is that they're fully funded or they're in the private schools, they're 100% covered, then one would think that there's no fiscal impact if they come into the public school setting. So I guess I'm confused with the argument. Maybe I'm just missing something.
Madam Chair, as Mr. Strom indicated, the cost would be the per pupil foundation formula cost that the non-public student is not currently provoking, that they would if they moved from the non-public to the public setting.
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, then why wouldn't we want to allow this to continue to happen then? Because then if you're already funding 100% of the special education costs, but the per pupil funding is coming from somewhere else. You're essentially leveraging dollars in a way that you wouldn't leverage them if they were part of the public system. So I guess it seems like there's a little disconnect, Madam Chair. I think I'll just kind of keep maybe talking with folks about this specific issue as this goes forward, but it just seems to me that there's a disconnect between if they're being served in a way that suits them and their parents, and in a way that actually costs less, I'm not sure why we would want to go a different direction, and that's what I'm struggling with.
Okay, thank you. So Russ and Gemma, the list is, at this moment, done, so we're ready for your amendment, or other amendments, anyone else? So Representative Demmer, you want to move it and tell us what number it was there?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'll move the H0002A47 amendment.
Okay, Representative Demmer moves the A47 amendment. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, first of all, this amendment has nothing to do with taxes. Madam Chair, and I appreciate your indulgence in accepting this. I did have this amendment or a similar one to it actually in the K-12 committee where we needed to do this, and the reason it didn't get done there is because we had some wording difficulties with blending it in and how it would work. Essentially, it relates back to a bill that I had, Madam Chair, members, that was heard. It involved encouraging school districts to embark on a quality improvement process working with the Minnesota Council for Quality and the Baldrige criteria, if people are interested in that, purely optional and purely at their choice. In my original bill, I had money in it. We gave incentive, we called diligence grants for districts who wanted to implement them to be able to fund putting the applications together. It's pretty broad-based if anybody's familiar with Baldrige. And then there was also a grant for certain achievement levels. Well, we knew that was not going to be something we could do this year, regardless of the merits of it. So what we did is we crafted a amendment that would work with the bill that did not have dollars, that basically put in place the concept of conceptual and systemic quality improvement for school districts. And so what we did is we put that in place. Section 14 of the amendment, lines 1.3 through 1.16, puts it into statute about encouraging schools to do this sort of thing. And then the lines 1.17 through 1.27, and continuing on the back page, I guess that's it. Basically, there's a section in Representative Greiling's Article 9 that talks about school districts not performing at certain levels and then having to come back with a plan to the commissioner in order to get to the quality levels we want. And what we did is the quality achievement part is embedded in different places, statutes. And then down below, where she talks about this plan, basically what we did is we said, and one of the things that school districts may want to consider in their plan for improving quality is the quality achievement of Minnesota schools, to refer back to it. Nothing mandatory, nothing that's put into place. I did not want it to be punitive, that if you don't achieve, you have to go through this process. That will not work. I did not want it to be something, the only time you should do it is if you weren't achieving. That would not work. So in essence, we're encouraging school districts to do quality improvement and look with the Minnesota Council for Quality and work with the Baldrige criteria or some other quality criteria. And then later on we're saying, and by the way, if you have to do a plan improvement, you may want to consider this other area of statute to look at as you improve a plan. So with that, we had a problem with the engrossing numbers. Now we got that all fixed, so it fits now, I think, into the bill properly, Madam Chair. And so that's why we're bringing it here instead of getting it done in committee. I've gone over this with Chair Greiling quite carefully. In fact, she encouraged me to bring it back in the committee so it would fit in better. And so I think we have some little work. So I appreciate your indulgence and the opportunity to offer it.
Okay, so Representative Dabney, can you tell us, can you turn into Representative Greiling for a minute and tell us where she's at on this amendment?
You know, I'm not sure I can do that, Madam Chair.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Representative Demmer is amending a section of the bill that Representative Loon spoke to earlier. We did have this hiccup in committee in terms of a drafting challenge. Representative Demmer has been an advocate for the Baldrige approach, I think all the time that he's been on the K-12 Finance Committee. I know this is acceptable to Representative Greiling. It's an interesting and, you know, can be a very powerful tool. So I'd encourage members to support.
Further discussion. Representative Carlson.
In light of our author's comment, I'll pass.
Representative Wheatley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say that the person who brought this forward happens to be a constituent of mine, and so I've heard a little bit about this, so I just want to support this and thank Representative Demmer for carrying this forward.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion? And call for the vote. All those in favor of the Demmer A47 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion carries. Amendment adopted. Further amendments? President Garofalo, please.
No further amendments, are there?
Does anyone have an amendment?
No.
Okay, so if not, President Garofalo.
Thank you. I just, Madam Chair, we had a good discussion about the K-12 shift and the $970 million that are shifted in that. But the total amount of shifts contained in this bill is actually over $1.5 billion, and it's a lesser-known shift. People are not familiar with the property tax recognition shift. And this, I don't suspect that at the end of the day, when we're done, when this becomes law, we're going to end up doing both these shift amounts and these quantities. But, Mr. Strom, if you could just take a couple of minutes, maybe explain to members what the property tax recognition shift is. I think people are generally aware of the K-12 stuff, but from a cash flow perspective, when we're deferring $1.5 billion of payments, this is pretty challenging. So outside of that statement, can you just elaborate on the property tax recognition shift?
Well, and that's great because we're going to close with an actual tax item because this committee does care about this piece. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, school districts receive their property tax payments from the county in two separate chunks during the year. And the first of those comes in May and June. And under current law, school districts receive that money in May and June and recognize it in the fiscal year that starts after July 1st. So unlike other units of local government that need to front the money, the school districts get half of their property tax money before the fiscal year to which they're attributable occurs. What happens is with the property tax recognition shift is that the state tells the school district the payment you're going to receive in May and June of the property tax, you're not really going to receive until the following year, and we're going to offset your state aid for that. So what essentially happens is school districts will take their June property tax proceeds, May and June property tax proceeds, recognize those in the fiscal year that's just ended. In a one-time basis, the state saves a great deal of money with that shift percentage, as you can see from the spreadsheet, about $600 million. And that recognition shift then means that essentially school districts are short on cash flow. They'll either have to use some of their reserves or do some short-term borrowing because that property tax payment that formerly came before the beginning of the next year is really shifted into the following fiscal year.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you for the amendments. Representative Carlson.
Just on that shift from the borrowing, Strom, you and I had conversations on the shift very early in the session. My understanding is structured where there's about $40 million available for the borrowing, but they said what we talked about at one time is that the case right now.
Madam Chair, yes, there's four school districts that are in a cash flow situation or that have low fund balances. There's a method for them to get a sped up cash flow. Yes.
I just wanted to understand. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Carlson. Further discussion? Further public testimony? If not, yes, Representative Broad?
Madam Chair, we're just going to request a roll call. Thanks.
Great. Okay, so roll call has been requested. Further discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, a question and then just a comment. Mr. Trump, we have done this shift before, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Rood, yes.
Okay, thank you. And then just a quick comment. I've known Representative Dabney for a number of years. I actually met before I was ever elected and know that he cares deeply about education issues. And Representative Grayling as well. I met before I was ever elected and worked with her on education issues before I came here. And I've had the pleasure of getting to know Representative Dietrich over and sit next to her on the floor and know that she also cares very deeply about education. And we are in very difficult times. And I think the bill isn't perfect, but I also think that it's like, to use the word that Representative Dietrich used, it's visionary. And, you know, if we don't know where we're going, any road will get us there. So I think this does put something out there that there's been a lot of discussion on. I appreciate all the work that the K-12 committee has put into that. I sit on the Health and Human Services Committee and, you know, really didn't want to come here to just throw people off of health care, and I'm hoping we can avoid that. But we will also be putting some reforms and continue to work on the reform issues in that committee as well, which I think we all need to do in all our committees. But just want to acknowledge that I think this session we will all be faced with making choices that we would prefer not to make. And just want to acknowledge that I know your commitment to education, Steve, and thank you for your work.
Thank you. And I just want to, if I may, to that point,
yes.
Representative Garofalo, please.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. Strom and my friend Representative Root brought up that we've done these shifts in the past. Mr. Strom, have we ever gone above 20% on the K-12 shift? We've done the property tax recognition shift, we've gone to 20. Have we ever gone above that?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, the highest shift percentage has been on the 8 payment shift has been 80%. So the 20% shifting 80% of the current year payments. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further, Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you. Have we ever had this large of a budget deficit?
Okay, thank you. Representative Carlson.
I mentioned earlier, Representative Rockwell, I think, may have been one of the questions. There were other shifts that we're talking here about the K-12 at 80-20, and one that came to my mind when we last had the discussion was what we used to have in higher education, which we called the 85-50. So Mark reminded me that that was at one point 80-20 shift there as well, about the same period. So there would be an accumulative number that would be different than what we have now. And I've never had any way to calculate what that would be, but we would have gotten somewhere down into the 70-some percent, I think, if you account for all the shifts. A little more complex, I think, than just the one before.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Loon.
I thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't want to belabor the debate here. I know we have other bills to take care of, but you know, I have to say again with regards to the funding for the miracle or the laying out the proposal that we go in that direction a few years ago. You know, I wasn't here in 2005, but I know we had a substantial deficit problem back then, and you know, this House, this body, this legislature could have done the same thing then and said, you know what, times are bad now, but in 4 years or 5 years, we're going to set this process in motion. And we would be sitting here today, if that was done at that time, having to come up with this additional money. And we have a serious recession on our hands. So, you know, we have a lot of smart people in this legislature, but none of us can predict where the economy is going to be, what's going to happen. And with regards to Representative Dietrich, you know, I am not going to defend our current funding system. It is broken, and it doesn't work. And I won't defend it for my district either. I would love to see it changed, and I think there are some good elements there. But unless we can say how we're going to pay for it, and assuming that circumstances are going to be better in 4 years, which I don't think any of us can say with any degree of certainty, again, this is a dangerous precedent. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, so Representative Liebling.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I just can't let this stuff go. Maybe I should, you know, because we've all got our different points of view. We've all got very selective memories. But, you know, talking about paying for things going out into the future. I mean, I wasn't here, Representative Loon, when the big tax cuts happened. But, I mean, I wish that Representative Rukavina was here, because she would be yelling about how this legislature created structural imbalance, you know, under Republican leadership here in the House by cutting taxes and those tax cuts and taking over education, and so taking on big expenses, cutting ongoing revenues to the state. That is a big, we're going to do it today without a way to pay for it going out. And you could, depending on what your theme is, you could say we're still suffering from that today, and that's a big part of why we're in this big problem that we're in. So, I mean, you can slice that different ways and look at it different ways, but, you know, it's really too bad you don't get to hear the Rukavina speech that we all get to hear when those kind of things get said.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And, you know, I am engaging in this discussion only because I think we have to refocus ourselves on what we're trying to accomplish now. And when we think about what is before us in the tax committee and some of the proposals that came from the governor's budget proposal, there are obligations for us in the 14-15 biennia of more than $700 million in relationship to the expenditures that he's wanting to make as tax cuts. So, you know, I think we just we have a job before us. We're all trying to do the best that we can.
to prepare for now and for the future, and spending time trying to point fingers at each other about how we're trying to solve the problem isn't going to help us get the job done today. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion.
Well, and Madam Chair, thank you. And I just want to say to Representative Liesling and to others, you know, I'm not here to defend things that were done in the past and stand on any policies that I didn't have any part of creating. All I can tell you is from where I sit today and the responsibility invested in me and the rest of us, and I can't do this in confidence that it's the best interest of the state of Minnesota, given our current economic situation and not knowing what the future is going to hold.
Thank you. Further discussion. Okay, so I am going to renew my motion now for House File 2331 as amended with the Demmer Amendment to send the bill.
Madam Chair, House File 2.
House File 2.
It would be better to renew your motion on House File 2.
I'll renew my motion for House File 2 as amended with the Demmer Amendment, two ways and means. Discussion. All those in, oh, roll call was requested by Russ and Broad. I apologize for that. The clerk will call the roll.
Winchester?
Yes.
Anderson? Broad?
No.
Carlson?
Yes.
David? Dabney?
Yes.
Demmer?
No.
Bill? Dietrich?
Yes.
Downey?
No.
Eastland?
No.
Gardner?
Yes.
Garoppolo?
Yes.
Hilton?
Yes.
Coonan?
Yes.
Coles?
No.
Lanning? What?
Aye.
Liebling?
Yeah.
Lockwood?
Yes.
Moon?
No.
Marquardt? Mullery?
Aye.
Murphy?
Yes.
Reinert?
Yes.
Rukavina? Rude?
Yes.
Silver?
Yes.
Tilbury?
Yes.
Zellers?
No.
Anderson? David? Phil? Lanning? Marquardt? Rukavina?
Okay, there being 17 ayes and 7 nays, the bill is passed and sent to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Dabney. We appreciate you. Thank you so much. And I'm now going to move.
Madam Chair, should we give Mr. Strom a thank you as well, since you wore about 4 or 5 hats today?
Thank you, Representative. Really, Mr. Strom. Yay. Bravo. And I think he's I think he's helping again here in a moment. So now it's and really, thank you. So I will now move reconsideration of House File 2088. Discussion to the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion carries. I will also now move House File 2088 before the committee to be considered and to be sent to Ways and Means.
Yes.
Discussion of the motion.
Yes.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The bill is before us. Welcome, Representative Swalwick, and I know you've come back as well, and you have to go off to get your son's senior photos taken. So, Representative Swalwick, we're trying to stick to the tax items in your bill. So,
well. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. I do have a few brief comments, and then we can talk about the tax issues. First of all, this is the Omnibus Early Childhood Finance and Policy Bill. I want to thank our committee for putting together a good bill, and I also want to thank Mr. Strom for being here today and pinch-hitting for Emily Adrians, who is our fiscal analyst. For the tax committee, your member that sits on our committee is Representative Downey. He is the lead on our committee, so he probably knows this bill as well as I do, and appreciate all his hard work in our committee. We do also have Representative Demmer, who's the co-chair of the Early Childhood Caucus on your committee, and he's been very involved in these issues as well. Very briefly, our bill encompasses two departments. MVE has the first three articles, early childhood education, community and prevention, and social safety and lifelong learning. The fourth article is the Department of Human Services. which has all the child care assistance programs, NSIP child care, basic sliding fee, and child care development grants. We have three goals this year: closing the achievement gap, getting more kids ready for kindergarten, and increasing quality on all levels. We also have a zero target and a $455 million budget. The main thing that would affect this committee, Madam Chair, is the shifts, which were 73-27 again. There are two spreadsheets, which I think the members have, that reflect those shifts and how they affect our budget. Otherwise, that's really the only tax issue we have in our bill.
Okay, thank you. Is there any public testimony on this bill? Anybody like to tell us what they think of this bill one way or another? Okay, discussion to the bill members. Discussion to the bill. Okay, so I think we're still getting some of the handouts. Discussion, because if not, we're just going to take a vote. Rep. Downey.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Salek, for the, I think, fine level of involvement that you gave our caucus in the bill and in the committee process this year. I'm wondering if, as the spreadsheets are coming out, maybe you could just describe, financially, this is very close to the governor's original proposals. Maybe the biggest difference is what you did with the additional shift money, if you wouldn't mind just describing that in terms of where that extra money was directed in your bill as compared to the governor's proposal.
Thank you, Rep. Wallach.
Madam Chair and Rep. Downey, a couple things. As you know, one, there's going to be an amendment in Ways and Means, so the goal's going to change a little bit with the Office of Early Learning and be downsized or right-sized, however you want to put that. As far as the shifts, one thing members were really lucky about in this bill is we have stimulus funds to the tune of $26 million. We have incorporated right into this bill. So part of it for that is we're working towards a quality rating system. And just like you rate restaurants from one star to five stars, we are going to start rating child care. So parents and consumers will know the quality of the child care. The governor's policies, we did all of the governor's policy recommendations for MDE except for a 12-hour recommendation on school readiness, and that was taken out. And we did on the governor's recommendations compared to ours on DHS. He proposed cutting provider rates by 3%. We did not do that. He also proposed increasing parent co-pays on child care, and we did not do that. And we did do a retroactive eligibility, which actually adds some money to the bill, but those are the main differences.
Okay. Further questions? Further discussion? Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Slavik, I don't know what your quality rating system ended up being, and I don't know if you can just tell me the points of it quickly, or is it too complex? Would you prefer for me to read something?
Madam Chair and Representative Dietrich, I'll tell you a little bit because it is something we're trying to showcase, and it's something I know Representative Demmer has also been very involved with. We're really taking this project called Parent Aware is being piloted by MELF, the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, who's headed up by Dwayne Benson.
Yep.
They go out of business, in essence, in 2011. So the big issue this year, because they're short on money, as everybody else is when does the state start to take that over? And also, when do we start to move more towards more of a statewide system? As we know, we can't afford it. We're not really proposing a statewide, that we're just going to do this everywhere. But to gradually allow child care to participate in this program is the idea. And so what some of the grants from the stimulus money do, they have grants to providers. So if you want it to be graded, you go through the process. They come out and they evaluate you, give you information back on maybe how to improve and good things they see. One thing we're getting is really good feedback on that's the most important thing that's happening. Say you got a 2-star, the state provides some money to help you improve your quality, and they give you, you have to again be rated and go through the process. This year specifically, we're looking at working with MELF to start to take over some of the pieces, along with the Department of Human Services, as well as allow more child care to participate in this throughout the state.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just chime in just a little bit extra here. And there are a couple of primary challenges, and Representative Slawick has alluded to them. One is where early childhood kind of bridges education and health human services.
with our child care and with education. And this is a very difficult situation, quite frankly, within the departments, and mechanically as well as philosophically. MELF has been running this pilot program now in a number of districts. I think, five districts? Something like that. A small number of districts, but they've been doing this pilot to try to gauge how we can measure quality. And one of the concerns that we have all shared, both on a bipartisan basis, is we don't want, you know, we have friends and family, neighbors that we have, where grandma taking care of and providing daycare, all the way up to the daycare centers that are very, very large and very well organized and run. And from my perspective, where I come from, I represent part of Rochester that has some very nice daycare centers and that sort of thing. I also come from rural areas where there's a lot of friends, family, and neighbors and that sort of thing. We did not want to get into the business, and this, again, as an early childhood caucus, of trying to say one is better than the other. All we tried to do is come up with a system whereby differences could be highlighted for parents, so we understand those differences without making those quality judgments, and also look at trying to find a way to come up with a policy for funding children in early childhood. We all pretty much agree we want good with early childhood. We all also agree that it's very, very important that parents are intimately involved in this. This is what it's about, because these are very, very young kids we're talking about, and it should be optional. It should be something they choose to do. But again, it's about providing information in a complex environment, and so I just needed to say that, just from the standpoint of, you know, what is parents aware? It's this rating system we're trying to do. We're not trying to say one's better than another. It's just about the qualities that may be different about different daycare type situations, and then let parents decide which seems to be better for them. And so anyway, it's been very interesting work and delicate work to work their way through. But I know Representative Slaw has been very involved since the inception. I was out for a little while, I'm back in, and it's been good, gratifying work, and not a lot of tax implication what I'm talking about, but I think it helps the committee to understand what's trying to be worked on here. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion? If not, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2088 be passed and sent to the Ways and Means Committee. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. Representative Swalwick, your bill has passed off the Ways and Means. Thank you for coming back today. We appreciate you being here with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And now we're going to go to Representative Lesch. And Representative Lesch got one done, but that discussion went on, so now we have his other bill. Representative Lesch, how did the rehearsal go?
Madam Chair, it was long and arduous. It took about 65 minutes to do what should have taken 25. It's very, very unlike tax committee.
Yeah. Okay, so what's
this
number?
Okay,
what number are we, Representative Glass? Do you want to move your bill?
Would move House File 2337, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Representative Glass moves House File 2337.
Thank you.
Please.
And Madam Chair, this bill is the same principle as the last bill. However, it directs that a static fee be charged per room as another way of getting at charge per room as another way of getting at the same problem. That said, it's directing them to collect the lodging tax. So it also, the other thing they're getting away with not paying is the sales tax, and it doesn't necessarily address that specifically, but it is getting the Department of Revenue to collect the lodging tax.
Okay, thank you. Discussion to the bill, members. Public testimony for or against this bill? For the discussion, I think we get the difference on this one.
Oh, sorry, you know what? Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Zellers is on top of it, and there is actually an amendment. And
Yes, if James, I think James has got, we'll take it from there, rest and less.
Okay.
So, Representative West, what's your amendment you're moving here?
Thank you. The amendment addresses the fact that there was a fee related to those more than 50 rooms and then a hotel that has less than 50 rooms, but it doesn't address the hotel that has exactly 50 rooms.
Here.
So I would imagine if this bill were to pass unamended, there would be serious
construction done in the city to make sure every hotel had exactly 50. That said, that's what it does.
Okay, so
and also it streamlines the city after city inserts or town, so it applies to cities or towns.
Okay, so Representative West moved the APB-H233-7A1 amendment. Discussion of the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. And so now, unless there's public testimony, we are going to lay over House File 2337 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Zeller.
Okay, thank you. So now, Representative Walker. Representative Zeller, I'm glad you're taking care of Representative West over there. We appreciate that. So, Representative Walker, what would you like to hear first?
I am able to pick them, and I think the one that will go fastest is House File 2334.
The Representative Walker moves House File 2334. Welcome.
Thank you, members. And Madam Chair, this bill, we heard earlier, Bill, that the CARE authored that tried to give some flexibility to local governments in responding to tough times. And this one follows along that path that allows the Minneapolis City Council, if the current local option sales tax, which is now dedicated to repaying the debt on the Minneapolis Convention Center, should have some excess because interest rates have gone down on it, but still have sales tax collections, have some excess, it would be able to use it to cover costs related to first, it will be used in the next 2 years to cover losses in local government aids and credits, and thereafter could be used for capital improvement projects in Minneapolis neighborhoods. I have to be honest, the expectation that this would be less than $1 million, with the way the sales tax is falling, it may not be anything, but in this economy, we're all trying to save jobs and preserve city services, and so it's just following along with the contents of some of the other bills that we've heard all along to help our local government survive tough times. With that, I'd be glad to answer questions. There's people here who could assist if there's detailed questions beyond
that. Okay. Discussion. Is there anyone who wants to speak for or against this bill? Okay, so I think we don't have people waiting for that. There's not discussion. I think we're going to ask our Minneapolis legislators on this committee to spend some time thinking about this concept and give us some more information this weekend and see what they all think. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not familiar with the historical context here. Was this future possibility a big part of the debate in the initial allowance of the sales tax? In other words, are we kind of going back on legislative intent when it was initiated? Does anybody know?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I was not here when the initial convention center was built. I don't even know when it was. We've seen a lot of local option sales tax bills come through here for other cities with their convention centers or for tourism and those sorts of things. But I suspect it was, we've seen others that have freed up the money for local purposes as well. So it seems to be there's a mix, but I'm not an expert on the history at all.
Thank you. Can we just take a break here for 1 minute? Can you join me in some applause here for Representative Carlson because it's his birthday? Representative Carlson, happy birthday. Representative Carlson.
Well, thank you. As long as somebody's asking how old I am, I don't care.
We're so sorry you're here today, but we're moving along. We'll get done.
I think I'll have a chance to get together with the grandkids this evening.
Okay. Happy birthday. Okay, so back to the bill. Any further questions? If not, we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you.
Okay, so thank you. And I'll represent Wofford, your other number, your motion is?
House File 2076 has a delete everything amendment.
Okay, so Representative Loeffler first moves House File 2076, and Representative Loeffler now moves the 2076 DE2 amendment to get the bill in the order if you would like it.
Madam Chair, I would like to make a couple of oral amendments.
And now so first let's get that in front of us. Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment is before us. Okay, Representative Wofford has an oral amendment to the DE2 amendment. Representative Wofford.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's always interesting to try to bridge two different worlds. And both our tax and our human service staff do absolutely bang up, great job. But sometimes translating between things is a little challenging. So on line 1.15, I would like to delete or federal, because all mandates to counties come through the state. And on line 1.18, I would delete and between collecting and allocating and insert or, because of the way federal matching requirements work in human services. And on line 1.19, I would like to delete within each county, because we have a transition period here that the bill provides for.
Okay. Representative Wofford now moves the oral amendment that on line 1.15 delete the words or federal, on line 1.18 change and to or, and on line 1.19 delete the words within each county. Discussion of the amendment. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion carried. Okay, so now we have your bill how you want it before us. Representative Wofford.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members. If you think back to earlier in the session, we had a fair amount of debate about match and maintenance of effort requirements on counties, and then we had a long and involved joint hearing with the Health and Human Services Finance and Policy Committees dealing with the fact that we have a pretty complex system for assessing property tax responsibilities to counties and delivering the Health and Human Services. And I think that since we spent so much time talking about education, I mean, it's time to identify the problem and the solution that's presented here in the context of education funding, because I found people outside of Health and Human Services better understand that than they understand the world that we inhabit in Health and Human Services. And that this bill tries to get Health and Human Services, the local county contribution, more like the contribution that school districts make to their school districts, which is an equal expectation for equal services that are mandated across the state. And the current situation that we have in Health and Human Services is you saw printouts that had summary data on 8 different columns of different types of human services. They actually summarized about 20 different individual programs with individual requirements. And so it's sort of like in funding schools, if we funded the math program with a 10% property tax expectation, and we expected the English program to have a 25%, and the school transportation we actually paid, if we're going to be similar to our consolidated chemical dependency treatment fund, we would pay for the buses in the first quarter 20%, but then we wouldn't pay for the buses in the second quarter, but we'd come back in with a 30% contribution in the third quarter. And then we have maintenance of effort requirements, which I always like to summarize as no good deed shall go unpunished, in which you can envision a situation in which a suburban school district says, looking ahead to the future, bioscience, biotech is the jobs of the future, and instead of offering 1 year of chemistry, we should be offering 3 years at the high school level. And so they add on an additional science teacher on using property tax dollars. And then other school districts say, you know, that is a great idea. We want our kids to get those biotech jobs, and we want them to graduate with more knowledge in chemistry. And so they convinced Representative Dabney to bring in a bill that says all school districts will get this extra special aid to hire more science teachers. Only the first suburban school district that added on that first three-year program in chemistry has to pay for it out of property taxes forever and ever. And that's how basically maintenance of effort works within all the various health and human service programs, although we have about 20 different variations. I think that's sort of as good a summary as I could come up with the complexities. So what this bill puts in place in 2012, and it's intentional that it is delayed to 2012, because those printouts that you saw at our joint meeting were good for illustrative purposes, they weren't actually good for projecting reality. And when you do and don't earn federal dollars and getting into the weeds of it all, I realize that we are not able to, at this point, do the kind of modeling that we would like. And we're also in Health and Human Services, as Representative Rood mentioned earlier, doing a number of different other reforms. And we really want to have all that put together and be able to really legitimately present it forward. But we at the same time want the Department of Human Services to take it serious. So what the bill does is says that we are going to have a consolidated program funding in which we will calculate the entire amount of the math and the maintenance of effort requirements across all these programs that are state mandated and create a uniform adjusted levy that will be a percentage of adjusted net tax capacity, and recognizing that some counties will be slightly below that, they will phase it in with a maximum 1% increase until they get to that average level across the state. It will be implemented in a way that continues to maximize our ability to earn federal funds, which in all of these different programs is a complicated game, but we think it's important to preserve services, and will result ultimately in a transparent system in which a county commissioner can say to his or her constituents, we are paying X percent of our adjusted net tax capacity towards supporting health and human services. And if the Health and Human Services Committee decides that they want to get rid of the 5,000 persons on the waiting list for developmental disability waivers, and they want to do it through putting more burden on property taxes, they're going to have to raise, let's say it's a 2% figure that's ultimately arrived at, they're going to have to raise it to 2.25. It's going to have to come to this committee. It'll be transparent. We'll know what the property tax impacts are on homestead credits, payments, CPR, and we'll have, I think, a much clearer and understandable local contribution into property taxes and allow our current health and human service programs to continue to earn maximum federal dollars. And there's going to be variations within each individual county, but when you look across all the 20 programs or so, for most counties, it actually ends up equalizing out. They tend to be a little higher one, a little lower on another. For those who are outliers, we're going to adjust with them with the phase-in. And so that's sort of a 90,000-feet view, and with that, I would be glad to answer questions.
Thank you, Representative Lauper. That actually was a very understandable explanation, so thank you. Questions from members for the author prior to hearing testimony? If not, I know there are some testifiers. If you would come forward and state your name for the record and offer your comments.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Mulder. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Minnesota Counties. I want to thank Representative Loeffler. She came to our meeting yesterday, Legislative Affairs Committee yesterday, and discussed this bill with us. And we had a long conversation about it. We believe that this bill does take a small step in the right direction and recognizes many of the key concerns that we brought to this committee at the beginning of this session. The issues of governance, transparency, flexibility, and outcomes. We think that this bill does move in that direction, but as we analyze the bill, we really believe that it has the opportunity to take a step farther than that. We believe that rather than going through the mechanisms that would be required in this bill, in which the state would basically combine a whole number of mandates into one kind of super mandate on counties, we believe that for most of the maintenance of efforts and for the federal cost shares, it would be more transparent and meet the needs of the of a better governance model if the state established a state property tax. And actually, as you require us to spend money currently, to do, for instance, there's one of the federal matches is to, we provide for individuals under 65 after 90 days in a nursing home. Counties are required to pay for 20% of the cost of that care, and the federal government pays for 80%. We believe that it would be more, the governance model would be better, it would be more transparent if the state were required to levy that tax, and if it's a property tax or a state tax, essentially to pay that cost. Why we believe that is that the county commissioners are required to raise property taxes for purposes of the county. In a governance model where they have no decision-making process about who gets the service, how much do you spend for the service, You're essentially the checking account for the service. That's really not a particularly good governance model. So by essentially creating a process where those services where counties do not are not part of the decision-making process, where county commissioners are not deciding who is eligible, they're not deciding the level of service that's being provided, we think it would be the responsibility of the state to essentially create and have a state property tax. And conversely, if this bill would move forward, we would ask that if not making it a state property tax, that the on our tax form, that it would actually say property tax required by the state of Minnesota for human services, for this piece of human services. By doing that, and there are a couple reasons we would like to see actually the first, but by putting this into our property tax, for one, it inflates, it will not be transparent to individuals who exactly was responsible for that increase. You would have to be pretty astute citizen to be able to know the difference between the basic maintenance effort is basically what you're going to call it, or something like that, or the way the schools are funded. I would guess most citizens don't realize that their school property tax is a function of decisions that you make here. But to create that kind of system, and then to be able to distinguish that part of the tax from all of the other things that counties do, I don't think that that is assisting in creating a more transparent system. Now, I shouldn't say that. It is more transparent than what we currently have. We believe it could be even more transparent. I guess with that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mulder. Questions from members on the possibility of a state property tax?
Yes, Representative. And I really appreciated the chance to present to a large group of county commissioners yesterday, and they were actually fascinated by the protests. I was like, can we get more detail like this? Because we have never seen ourselves compared to other counties. So it was a fun and useful discussion. I had also never heard the concept of potentially a state takeover using a state property tax. And I think it's an intriguing idea. I think this sends, you know, the proposal I have before you, I think, has thought through what the implications are as much as we can on federal, earning federal aid and all those other sorts of things. I think that going to a new concept like that would probably take a little more analysis. So I'm still hoping we'll tee this up and establish it as a policy direction, and we'll have, before 2012, opportunities to further explore the idea that emerged in the discussion yesterday.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to ask Mr. Mulder, that's an interesting idea, kind of what Representative Wofford said. I mean, it would take a lot more thinking. And we obviously can't do that here today, and we're on a pretty short timeline now to have a big new idea come up. But I wasn't really clear whether you're saying that you're okay with what she's doing here. Is that the case?
I think that we are intrigued by the idea that, and we'd be more than willing to have the conversations around the idea. Our concern is that given the vagaries of state and county budgeting, and I know this is not the intent of the bill, but once the state would begin to say, okay, the county is going to levy X amount for this purpose, that it becomes another revenue source for the state to require us to spend money in a way that, rather than that the state legislature must take responsibility directly for increasing those in those kind of programs. We believe that there are parts of this bill that make a lot of sense, and we really appreciate the recognition that this bill brings to the relationship between state and county, and that the recognition that this bill has is that it is state decisions that are driving these costs at the county level. These are not driven by local county commissioners making a decision. So we do appreciate that, and we believe that this is a really interesting way to begin to address the problem. I think at the end of the day, if this were the solution after 2 years, I think our folks would be very challenged by that. Because, and part of it is that we know there's a lot of work that has to happen in the next 2 years, and I would not say we're going to oppose, we don't support it, but we also don't oppose it at this point.
Representative Lieberman?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad you said that last piece, because I wasn't really sure where you were going through all of that, because, you know, I heard you sort of framing this as a choice between this bill in front of us and the other thing that you're talking about, and that's, to my mind, not the choice we have here today. I think we have the choice between this and nothing on this issue, and so, you know, I'm glad to hear that you're not opposing this, and I mean, the fact that, you know, this isn't as much as we'd like to do. I mean, I think there's a lot of more understanding now. I mean, I'm in my fifth year in the legislature. I never understood until this year anything about this maintenance of effort thing, and it's my second term on the Health and Human Services. So, you know, I think we do need to do a lot more work in this. You know, I'm not blaming anybody that I don't understand about maintenance of effort. You know, I mean, we all have a lot on our plates, but I don't remember anybody like coming to me and trying to get me to understand that up until this term, this year. And I'm hoping we can keep working on this. But you know, I'm glad to hear that you're not opposing this step forward.
Mr. Mulder,
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the challenges that we have, and it's a fundamental challenge about using the property tax itself to provide these programs, is that in too many cases there's an inverse relationship between the use of the programs and the ability to pay for the programs. Some of our poorest communities have significantly higher, the counties have significantly higher costs for these services because of the fundamentals of the demographics that exist across the state. If you looked at our statistics, those counties that happen to have an Indian community or a tribe or a reservation within their county generally will have higher costs than those that don't. It's also tied to poverty. General poverty areas, places that are poor, have higher costs. We are also finding that the demographic on age is driving significantly. If you look across the western portions of our state, the demographic regarding age is a much more serious issue about it within the context of what their property taxes are than almost any other thing. So what we like about Representative Loeffler's proposal is that it begins to recognize that there are not unique service delivery areas from the sense of how do you pay for this. We also believe that as this goes forward, and I think Representative Loeffler is part of the reason that we want to work with her on this. This is only one piece of which is a three-legged stool on this thing. One is the issue of how do we pay for social services in this state. The second is how do we deliver social services in this state, and we've been working with Representative Thiessen and others to come up with our authority legislation that will allow us the ability to begin to reorganize how we do the delivery system, the structure that we do. The third thing that we're working on and is the most difficult is how do you create more flexibility and more innovation in the system. Part of our program for the authorities is to really initiate an aggressive waiver program wherever possible within the state to allow counties to be more creative and groups of counties to be more creative in how we do things rather than being caught in the trap that we are today. And I will only say the most frustrating piece that you get in, if you go into a county and talk to one of our social workers, is the fact that they're spending 50 to 60% of their time filling out reports that they send to somebody else, rather than actually dealing with the people that need these services. And those, so in the end, we think that the financing piece that Representative Loeffler has put forward and the concepts around which he has put it forward are part of this broader discussion.
Representative Laughlin, do you have a comment to that point?
Yes. Mr. Chair and members, I totally agree with we need to simplify and we need to focus on outcomes rather than process mandates, and that's what the first part of the bill that we deleted with the Delete Everything Amendment dealt with, because that's appropriately dealt with in the Health and Human Services Policy and Finance Committee. And so we're all working together on that better and more simplified structure. I would say, though, on the financial side right now, we are routinely, year after year, potentially increasing property taxes in Health and Human Services Finance without even a discussion that that's what we're doing. And this change is to make that transparent and upfront. I was in a conference committee in which there was neither a max nor a maintenance of effort on either side, the House or Senate, but it emerged because there's not enough money to do all the grand things that both sides want to do. And it came up and got imposed in order to stress the state dollars to the goal that advocates felt was necessary to be effective without any discussion, even within the committee, let alone with others involved in property taxes, that would have a property tax implication. And so the goal of this is that by 2012, we will have a system in which if for a program, one of those 20 programs or a new 21st program, there's a new expectation that counties are going to contribute new money, it has to be raised up and become a property tax discussion rather than hidden in a 400-page Health and Human Services Committee bill. Whether there should be, I mean, at the first meeting of the Health and Human or of the Property Tax Division, Representative Marquardt, who isn't here, asked all of us to say what were our goals and what were the topics that we wanted to talk about and pursue in the division. And one of the things that I said was I think we should have a debate about what revenue source should pay for what services. What should property taxes pay for versus general sales and income taxes? And the discussion that you're participating in right now and serving is really about that. Should county property tax dollars be expected to pay? And I think that's a broader debate, and I welcome and join Mr. Mulder in saying that is a serious debate we should have. But until we have that, I really want us to at least make it clear that when we add on a maintenance of effort or a max or change it, it should be related to property taxes, and that we should have a connection between those areas, just as we have between education when they bring the education bill forward and tell us what the property tax implications are. This is to bring it into that area and to try and streamline it so it's actually understandable to people who don't understand all 400 pages of the human service bill.
Representative Carlson.
I'll step.
Any further questions from members? Is there other testifiers who would like to come forward? If there's anybody else in the audience that wants to testify for or against the bill, if you could perhaps move down and prepare. Thank you. Yes, for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson from the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I too want to thank Representative Loeffler for working on this subject that for way too long has been below the radar screen of the legislature as to the decisions being made in the Health and Human Services Committee's effects or impacts on local property taxes. I want to answer the question that was raised by Representative Liebling. But before I do that, I do want to say I endorse completely the comments that Mr. Mulder made. I think it is very appropriate that this be converted to a state tax, because if you do not, depending on what, if any, additional state funding is provided by this bill, property taxes being levied by some counties would be being remitted to the state for redistribution to other localities, and that frankly would be unprecedented. If on the other hand you provide sufficient state funding where the local effort is at a level where the vast majority of counties are expending or levying property taxes at the levels that they're currently, that issue goes away. So it really depends on what sort of level of funding. And I will give you specific examples. I understand Representative Loeffler's frustrations with the lack of data from the Department of Human Services. We share that frustration. But based on the preliminary data that's available, if the local effort were set at the current statewide average of 3.45% of adjusted net tax capacity for all these maintenance of efforts and cost shares, 46 counties would have to raise their property taxes to come up to this uniform level. If, on the other hand, that level of local effort is lowered to 2%, we're only talking about 18 counties that would be have to raise their property taxes to come up to that level. Because so that becomes, frankly, a much more manageable issue, more palatable politically. But I will warn you that the difference between the 3.45% and the 2%, again based on preliminary data, and ignoring the fact that this phases in, which would add additional costs, it will cost you $98 million a year, again based on preliminary data. I'm not sure that the financial wherewithal is going to be there to fund those costs coming down the line. Again, I very much appreciate Representative Loeffler's attempts to address this issue. I strongly endorse the statewide organization, Mr. Mulder's suggestions that this be converted to a statewide tax so that the entity that's responsible for these, posing these costs is clearly delineated as the entity that, in effect, levying these taxes. And finally, with regards to our support or lack of it, again, it depends on the funding. If there's adequate funding provided to bring it down to a lower level, 2% or less, we can go along with this. But if it stays at current levels, it will be very, frankly, very difficult to support. I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Bruton.
I don't have a question, but a comment, but actually maybe it looks like Ms. Dalton maybe wanted to or could respond to some comments that were just made, and then
Mr. Chair, I think it would be helpful to have Ms. Dalton explain how this works, and it actually is set at the current level of local contribution. The goal is not to increase it a penny. It is, and to make sure that it earns the same amount of dollars. Now, as Mr. Carlson said, it will vary a little within counties. When we started out, we had all kinds of things that we didn't know if they were mandated or not, and if there were what the match was and wasn't as we were assembling the dollars. And 2% was the last number that we've been able to kind of have clarity, more clarity on. But that's been part of the problem, is reestablishing the base. But it will have some shifting between counties, and Ms. Dalton can address that.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Members of the committee, I guess I need to work on my poker face. The bill would not actually cost the state money, and I think that needs to be clarified. The way it's written right now, there would not be a cost to the state, because the way the percent of tax base going into this maintenance of effort is set is it's supposed to be equal to what is currently being raised statewide by the counties or being paid statewide by the counties for these programs. As Representative Loeffler said, and as Mr. Carlson said, yes, there will be a shift between counties, and that shift is set so that the most any county can go up, their county tax levy could go up, would be 1% a year due to this phase-in. I mean, I think the thing to keep in mind is that right now the size of the inequity in terms of how counties are paying for health and human services. Right now, some counties are there's a county that's paying less than 1% of their tax capacity as health and human service maintenance of effort. We have one county that we think their number is wrong, but based on what we've got from health and human services, it's paying 31% of their tax capacity for health and human services. We think that's probably high. But we have 10 counties that are paying over 5% right now.
So
Ms. Root?
Go ahead, Representative. No, just a little. Well, I just want to say thank you, Ms. Feltman. Sorry, you don't have a good poker face. I just wanted to thank Representative Loeffler. When we had that hearing here with Health and Human Services and Taxes, I think is the two that got together to talk about maintenance of effort, it was really mind-blowing, I think, to hear. It was just so amazing to me how complicated that issue was. And I know that you spent a lot of time on this, and I appreciate that. And I hope that the discussion will continue and that we will have a discussion. I think sometimes here at the legislature, the discussions take place in silos. You hear that a lot. But this is one area that we really need to cross over. And Representative Loeffler, I'm sure the counties know, and if they don't, they should, that you are the voice. You are like the conscience for the counties, I think, when we are in committee and having discussions, because you do always bring forward, you know, how is this going to impact the counties? And you really bring that awareness to our group. So thank you for all your work on this effort, and I hope that we will continue to move forward, because I do think this is a really important issue.
Are there testifiers? Representative Loeffler, final comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, the other thing that I think it's important to think about, too, is you might recall the testimony of Judith Rumsfeld, who's from Carver County, one of the growing counties, and how she can't make her budget up on knowing what she even owes, except by guessing. And there's some pretty serious penalties if you guess wrong, because the data, even that the county human service directors need to estimate their local share, is that complicated. The other thing that really, I think, troubles me, and I don't represent a small population, rural county, but they're really at risk right now. Because if they happen to have born to someone in their community, a severely disabled child who needs 24-hour around-the-clock nursing care, or they have a family that suffers, you know, terrible traumatic brain injury and needs all kinds of community supports, it can really throw the budget and the property tax demands of that community out of whack in a way that they can't predict or control. And by setting a base contribution across the counties, I think in the end we're going to allow county commissioners to do a better job of administering, and also state decision makers to have a better understanding of how our decisions, whether it's in the tax committee or in human service committees, are going to affect people and the taxpayers of our districts. And so I'm looking forward to working with everyone and their creative ideas on how to implement this in a way that doesn't cause tax, you know, surprises to anybody, and that does, that also allows the people who are dependent on these services to continue to receive them.
With no further questions then, Representative Loeffler renews her motion to lay over House File 2334 as amended. Pardon me? One second, I'm Bill Newman. 2076 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Lenchesky with two bills. Do you know which of the two you want to do first here?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. House File 2331, if I may.
Representative Lenchesky moves House File 2331 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Is that right, Representative Lenchesky?
Yes.
And you have an amendment that you'd like to offer as it comes before us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I may, if I could move the H2331A1 amendment to get the bill in the order I would like it.
Representative Lenchesky moves the H2331A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The author has the bill in the form she would like to present it. Representative Lenchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if I may, I asked Mr. Michael if he could just walk us through this. This came to us from the state auditor. So if Mr. Michael could just...
Mr. Michael.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill is in fact a request from the Office of the State Auditor. It sort of simplifies and streamlines the TIF plan requirements and the annual financial reporting. Those are the two biggest parts of this. And of course, the annual financial reporting is the reports are made to the state auditor's office, so this affects their reporting documents and their financial summary information and so forth. To sort of encapsulate what this really does is the current TIF plan requirements and the financial reporting for individual TIF districts requires accounting for not only tax increment revenues, but also other revenue sources that those programs and plan operations may have. This could be grants from deed, it could be other monies that the city puts into the project from its own funds, it could be developer payments and those sorts of things. From the state auditor's perspective, this causes complications in that their oversight responsibilities really principally focus on tax increment and not on these other components, and they often have difficulty sort of sorting out and the segregating of the two types of funds. And so really what this bill does is to change, first of all, the mandatory plan requirements for tax increment to just focus it exclusively on the amount of tax increment that's expected to be collected and how the authority will use that tax increment. And then secondly, in the reports that would be filed with the state auditor, only the tax increment amounts would be reported and not all of these other items. And the auditor makes the point that this will eliminate sort of what appears to be double counting on their forms and so forth. Sections 3 and 4 are not really related to that. They're just making a couple of other minor changes in the tax increment law. The first one in Section 3 exempts the mandatory payments to counties for administrative costs from the cap that applies to administrative expenses for TIF districts. And the fourth one changes the point at which the interest rates on interfund loans are set to the date of authorization rather than to the date the loans are actually made. That way the cities will know when they approve these loans what those interest rates will be because they're floating interest rates.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Representative Winchesky, any other comments to add?
Nothing else from me, Mr. Chair. Again, it's a request. The TIF working group has looked at it, Representative Stemmer, Lanning, Reiner, and I, and we're just looking for input from the committee as well.
And just to clarify, the A1 amendment is largely just, I don't want to call it technical, but it's semantic as compared to anything substantive. Is that correct?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes.
Any questions or comments from members? Any public testimony on the bill? Hearing none, with that, Representative Winchesky renews her motion to lay over House File 2331 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. On to number two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move, if I may, House File 2323 for possible inclusion. Mr. Chair, if I may, I also have an amendment.
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, if I could move the H23-23A2 amendment.
Representative Winchesky is moving House File 2323 with the author's amendment H23-23A2. So the bill is now before us in the author's preferred format. Any questions or discussion on the amendment? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Representative Winchesky.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this, if I may, I would just ask Ms. Manzi, this is a new federal conformity since we last did federal conformity earlier this year, since Congress has acted again. And members should know that the governor has, in his supplemental budget, he made some recommendations in the area of federal conformity as well. And so it will be, again, a discussion for yet before we adjourn for changes in the omnibus tax bill. And so this, if Ms. Manzi can just walk members through the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill would conform and update Minnesota's tax references to the one federal law that has been enacted since our most recent conformity bill, Chapter 12, and that is the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, also known as the Federal Stimulus Law. Most of the changes in the law affect business taxes. There are a few that affect individual income taxes. Minnesota would conform to many of the changes. On the at the top of the second page of the summary, it lists the items that Minnesota would not conform to, and that is the federal deferral of discharge of indebtedness income, and that's going to be mostly for businesses, but could also be for individuals. Second would be the deduction of the first $2,400 of unemployment compensation. Third would be both an additional itemized deduction and an addition to the standard deduction for sales tax paid on motor vehicles that are purchased between February 17th of this year and December 31st of this year. And finally is the extension of 50% bonus depreciation to tax year 2009. That final item is an item that we have consistently not conformed on, I think, since 2002 or 2003, and this just continues to require the same treatment of federal bonus depreciation at the state level, in which taxpayers have to add back 80% of the additional amount claimed at the federal level in the year that it's claimed at the federal level, and then they get to subtract one-fifth of that over the next five tax years, so it's a timing issue, in which it's going to be spread over 6 years at the state level rather than all in 1 year as at the federal level. The rest, the bill itself goes through and it updates the date of the Internal Revenue Code that we're conforming to in various sections of the tax statute, and then it requires additions and subtractions for the items that we're not conforming to. Provides a little more detail in the summary on Section 2 on the various major changes in the federal stimulus law. Section 3 has the additions. Section 4 has the subtractions, the main subtraction for individuals, and the subtraction is for the discharge of indebtedness income. And that's actually a deferral item at the federal level. What's happening at the federal level is that they are going to allow discharge of indebtedness income that would otherwise be recognized in 2009 or 2010 to be deferred until 2014, and then spread out over a five-year time period. Minnesota instead would take that income into taxable income in 2009 or 2010 as it would have been under previous federal law, which means that in 2014 to 2019, when people are recognizing it at the federal level, we have to allow them to subtract it from their Minnesota return, or else they would be including it twice. And that's not the intent. The intent is simply to count it right now when it happens rather than deferring it. Sections 5 and 6 have the corresponding additions and subtractions for corporations. Section 7 is another update to code reference. Section 8, because we're adding more additions and subtractions, we have to adjust our non-resident ratio used for apportioning tax for people who are residents for only part of the year. Sections, 9, 10, 11, and 12 are all updates in the date of the code reference. And that concludes the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Just a couple quick questions before you finish. The areas of non-conformity, and this may be, I'm not sure, a question for you or for Representative Lanchesky or somebody else, but do any of those non-conformities actually restrict our ability to utilize stimulus funds? Ms. Manzi or Representative? Anybody know?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't believe so. I did neglect to mention an item that was included in the author's amendment, and that is not strictly an ARRA item, but instead the author is conforming to federal section 179 expensing beginning in tax year 2009 and then moving forward. The federal stimulus law extended the increased amount for section 179 expensing to tax year 2009, and this bill would pick up that change, so Minnesota would have the same expensing as is allowed at the federal level.
And Representative Winchester, you mentioned something about this compared to perhaps the governor's proposal along the same lines. I didn't totally catch that. Is there a significant discrepancy between what he wants or what is included in his most recent budget proposals and where this is, or are we pretty aligned here?
And I don't have them side by side, but Ms. Manzi probably knows fairly well. No, there's definitely difference because he's spending money on some things that is not in this bill, and I am, I think, on some things that he's not. And then I think the Senate's working through something else. But, of course, that would be all sort of
right.
part of the negotiation, but I think Ms. Manzi probably has a pretty good grasp on what how the governor's proposal differs from this one, so I, you know, I'd be interested to hear it too.
Mr. Chair, with regard to the Section 179 exemption, the governor proposed to conform to that in his initial budget recommendations, and then his supplemental budget recommendations expanded to include the extension of the increased amount to tax year 2009. With regard to the other items, I believe that the governor is proposing to conform on the deduction of the first $2,400 of unemployment compensation. And I don't believe that the governor is proposing to conform on any of the other items, but I know that Ms. Cadoon is here from the department, and she perhaps can correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Ms. Cadoon? And if there's any other public testimony for or against the bill, if you'd make your way down, that'd be great. Ms. Cadoon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Ms. Manzi was correct on what you said for the governor's recommendation. I'd also mention when the governor put together his recommendation, we didn't have quite all the details as well on the revenue impact. So I don't think he would be actually opposed to some of the additional items. It was just more we didn't have all the information on the revenue impact at that point. So the two items, Section 179 would be exactly the same as the governor's rec. And the bigger item where we're differing at this point is the unemployment compensation piece, which has a revenue impact of about $28 million for fiscal year 10. And I also, if I could just take a moment just to thank the chair for bringing forward this bill, and once again, and being a big proponent of federal conformity, because we think that's obviously very important for the ability of taxpayers to comply with our tax laws.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Questions from members? Ms. Manzi, anything to add to that, or Representative Lanceski?
No, thank you, Mr.
All right, with that, Representative Lanceski renews her motion to lay over House File 2323 as amended for possible inclusion in the tax omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Lanceski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hearing no further business,
wait,
we are.
Yes.
I move to adjourn and request a roll call.
Representative Braun has requested a roll call on the adjournment. We are adjourned.